Blog Talk Radio.
How about that? Brought to you by McDonald's and Chevrolet. That was a cut from Soul Train back in the day. Blue Magic. And we will have Blue Magic with Richard Pratt here in Charlotte, North Carolina, September the 6th, 2014, at the Neighborhood Theater. We will be talking about that later, and this is The Last Word. Good afternoon. Last Word with Michael Lawson. And I want to tell you, things are heating up. We are going to have a show today that is going to be smoking. When I tell you smoking, smoking. we're going to have, oh, man, I can't even tell you. We got a list of people on the show today that is going to be, it's going to blow your mind. We have Mr. Daryl Dawkins. Why do I keep saying Daryl Dawkins? Robert Dawkins. Well, when Robert calls in, we'll ask him if he's any relation to Daryl. I don't think so. But anyway, Robert Dawkins from Democracy North Carolina will be here. We will have Mr. David Adams here, our resident columnist for the show. Of course, we'll have the other superstars, Mr. Thomas Fortenberry, who will be calling in because he's not going to be here today in studio. But we will also have quite a few other people who are going to be calling in about what is going on in this country with the black men shooting. Black men are being shot like ducks in a barrel, and not even with a gun or weapon in their hand. There's a news conference going on right now with the sheriff of Ferguson. They have now talking about a surveillance tape with the two individuals, the young man Brown that was killed. But they threw the stuff up against the wall so people can now have some sort of reluctance to say Michael Brown and Dorian were innocent people. The police chief, well, I'm talking, just said, oh, they have nothing to do with it, and the policeman who was involved in the case did not know about this surveillance tape at the time. So why even bring it up? It's just like when you go to court and the prosecutor talks about the defendant and talks about the defendant's when he was young, when he used to pull the tails of animals. What the heck does that have to do with him now by committing voter fraud? You know, that's how stupid and how wide-ranging it is. They released a report today, the police did, that says, an incident report that says there is a complaint on a surveillance video complaint on the second suspect. A complaint says the surveillance video shows Brown scuffling with an employee. The complaint says that the employee tried to stop suspects from leaving the store. Yeah, and? So, Well, what does this have to do with the man being shot in the face and in the chest probably two or three times? What does it have to do with it? So you see the maliciousness of this daggone police department. The police chief said, well, I've been sitting on it, and I couldn't sit on it anymore. I mean, it's just unbelievable. He said, so the reason why I released it is because I released the officer's name. What the hell does that do with anything? So now the question was just asked to him, why are you releasing information piecemeal? Is it to assassinate the character of Mr. Brown and Dorian? And the Brown family has just said the police strategy of attempting to blame the victim will not divert our attention from being focused on the autopsy ballistic report and the trajectory of the bullets that caused Michael's death, and will demonstrate to the world the brutal execution of an unarmed teenager. That was just released by the Brown family. It's just unbelievable. So he said, I released everything I have. I released everything I have, including the policeman's name. But why did they release this alongside of the policeman's name? So, I mean, there is no way that this police department, they are impartial. They're covering their ass. That's all it is. That's all they are doing. They're covering their daggone ass. Now, and anybody who knows anything about, I think that has a complete, I mean, any sort of idea of fairness. And he said, oh, so now they ask him, is the policeman secure? Well, Michael Brown damn well wasn't secure. He was shot down. Now the police chief saying, oh, because the question was asked, was the policeman aware of what went on with this involvement in this surveillance tape? And he says, well, stuttered a little bit and says, I'm not aware of that. So he said, how come the ambulance got there so late? Well, they got there in 45 minutes. Oh, 45 minutes with a man bleeding to death in the middle of the street with no offer of trying to save this boy's life, even though he probably was dead at the scene. He said, so the question was asked, regardless of that, why did he stop Michael Brown? He said, because he was walking down the street, the middle of the street. So therefore, you are going to be executed by the police if you are walking down the middle of the street, if you are jaywalking. This is what it's come down to. This is what it's come down to. We can execute you if you're a black man and you are walking down the middle of the street. I mean, this man needs to be fired. This man needs to be, for even having the gall and the temerity to have that come out of his mouth. It's a disgrace. He said, now they're asking him about the state police. So he's saying that the policeman suffered severe injuries to the side of his head. So he said, anything I tell you is what was already released by the St. Louis County Police Department. Pass the buck. So I'm trying to convey this as we're hearing it live. So if you just hold on, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to feed you this update. So this policeman was a gentle, quiet man. He's describing the officer as a gentleman and as a quiet officer. And this shooting has devastated his life. So now the question is, if the murder and the robbery did not coincide, why was it released now? His answer was, ready for it? The press asked for it. Well, how the hell did the press know about it? Come on. You know, there's a TV series on TV right now called The Bridge. Fabulous on FX. And I want to tell you, This looks like how the Mexican police account for all their disappearances and murders. This guy is, he better get somebody else to speak for him. Because he says, if the murder and the stop by the policeman didn't occur at the same time, or he wasn't involved in looking for this robbery, why did you release it? He said, because you all asked for it. He said, we didn't ask for it. This is what he just said. We did not ask for it. We didn't know about it. Thomas Jackson needs to have someone speak for him. We cannot be sure that Michael Brown is on that videotape. It just looks like another big black man. So the tape is irrelevant. I mean, this is complete nonsense. The tape is irrelevant. Now, the police chief said there was no connection. Why release it? See, he said, so if the police officer didn't know about it, why'd he shoot Michael Brown? For some Skittles, maybe? Did Michael Brown steal Skittles at the store? Or did this person on this videotape steal Skittles from the store? So therefore, the policeman had a right to stop and shoot and kill. Well, I want to know is, if both Michael Brown and Dorian were in this surveillance tape from this store, why didn't he shoot both of them? They were both there. This makes no daggone sense at all. But it's the point that we're going to be talking about later with Robert Dawkins of Democracy, North Carolina. And we're also going to be interviewing today a candidate for sheriff. He is a Republican, but he's African American. I want to hear what he has to say about this whole 9 yards. I want to hear what he has to say about this. His name is Chris Haley. He is a great guy, and I would vote for him for sheriff, even though he's a Republican. Because just because you have voted Democrat or Republican your whole life, as I say, maybe you were wrong. Because everybody that's a Democrat is not for African-American welfare or low-wealth people or people of color. They might say they are, but that don't make it true. So we now, getting back to this case, we now have piecemeal information. And this is going to make this a major problem for these racists, which I'm going to call them racists, in Ferguson County Police Department. Now, I tell you, I have spoken to many a police officer since this has come up, at least a half a dozen. I was hoping to have two on the show today, the two I wanted, but they are at a, I think it's an FOPD function. One is going to try to call in. Detective from New York. African American. I believe over 20 years. I've spoken to officers. Every single officer I've spoken to has been an officer for more than 20 years. Have worked in the highest concentration areas of criminality. Worked in the worst neighborhoods. And in 20 years, none have drawn their weapon. Why is it that we have policemen who have been policemen for 4 years or less and have drawn their weapon a half a dozen times or more and have shot people? And everyone has been white. I mean, give me a break. There is something wrong with this picture. There is something wrong with this picture. Now, when I say everyone, when we're talking about 0.000, it's everyone. It's zero. 0.005, that's still zero when we're talking about 200,000 cops in this country. Now, let me explain something here. All the policemen in this country and sheriff deputies in this country, most of them, I'd say 90% of them, I'm giving a good break there, 90% of them, are great policemen and sheriff deputies. There is only that rotten barrel few that taint every one of them. This blue coat of silence and this world camaraderie, brother, you need to get rid of that and kick these, words fail me, people out of your midst, because they only make it worse for the rest of you. You got 21,000 plus people that live in Ferguson, Missouri. You have 3 black policemen out of 53 saying that you have tried to recruit, but you can't get anybody. Where are you recruiting at? In the precincts? Are you going door to door into the neighborhoods? Has any one of those policemen gone door to door and asked for recruits? Have they gone to the high schools and asked for recruits? Don't tell me they have. That's a lot of bull. You and I both know that. The police have now armed themselves since, let me stand up while I salute, Ronald Reagan gave the order when he became president in 1980 that the civilian police departments throughout this country could now buy surplus military hardware and gear. That was Ronald Reagan. He's the one who has militarized the police departments in the United States. He's the one that's authorized black helicopters. So when you say that Bill Clinton and Barack Obama are coming to take your guns away, it was not them. It was your main man, Mr. Ronald Reagan. We're going to have a continuing show on this next week, and we're going to go into depth what Ronald Reagan did about this. But he's the one that authorized it originally. And I can't think of the authorization code, But it was 1980 when he was president. He authorized it. And how they do it, they get a grant. With that grant, they can go buy surplus APVs. They can buy minesweepers. They can buy machine guns, M16. They can buy Kevlar. They can buy fatigues. They can buy grenade launchers. These military cruisers. Every single thing that our Delta Force has, they can buy. Now, why did Ronald Reagan want to arm the policemen in this country with that type of weaponry? Why? And now we're twisting it around and saying that it's the we need these ultra right wing nut jobs are out there saying we need to protect ourselves from our government. Yeah, you need to protect yourself from the government that you want, because they're the ones that want to take your guns away and want to kill you. It ain't the liberal establishment. It's the conservative establishment that set this all up. I mean, it's just you just listen to this. If I can open it up. I don't know why I can't bring it up here. Let me go on another link here while I'm talking to you. I just don't understand. I've been having a lot of problems with the program. I don't know where I could. It would not open up to me. None of it would open up. So let's see if this will open up. Let's see here. Mr. Thomas Fortenberry, are you there? Nope, you're still one.
Hello, sir. How are you?
Yeah, well, you know, on the screen here, I'm having a lot of problems. I'm looking at this. You are not connected, according to this.
Oh.
And I was trying
okay.
to. So let me see. Let's see what reload does. Reload. Okay, now you're up, and let's see here if I can. There was something I wanted to play. Let's see if it plays. You know, it will not play open. So I have no idea why this play.
I
got a lot of stuff. It can't be all right because I got a lot of stuff I need to talk about and a lot of stuff that needs to be played here.
Yeah.
It needs to be opened up.
But
and
here's one thing
clips would open
to,
up. Go ahead.
To look ahead. At. We've got the dual front going. You know, Reagan started these things or expanded
yes, that's
them, we'll say,
about.
Because actually they started first with the, if you remember, this all goes back to our favorite boys that have been in office forever, the Cheneyites. But after Vietnam, they actually started the militarization of the police because of civil rights. And they wanted
yes,
to also,
well,
you know, do something with all the equipment. So they created the SWAT teams, right? And the SWAT
right.
teams were
Remember
these
the movie?
Specialized weapon and tactics divisions of police that were supposed to have military weapons for very specific things like, you know, gangs or mafia raids or something like this, supposedly, right? But that was the actual start of all of this. Then, of course, they were back in office under Reagan, so they expanded it slightly. But the huge rise that we see now, and what you're talking about, the block grants that they get now from the Justice Department and the military, that all came about under W as part of our beautiful USA Patriot Act, the response to 9/11 and the supposed terrorist threat that we were all under. They're the ones that put into law that the military, all military surplus could be dumped for free onto the police departments and anything else they needed to support that. Like, that's how they get those things like, you know, huge military assault vehicles that they don't need, but, you know, they can drive
right.
Bearcats down the streets of our, you know, cities. But then when they need to reload, you know, and get some more rubber bullets or tear gas or whatever, then they get the grants to pay for new ammo. But it's insane. I mean, it and, you know, all of us, you know, wimpy liberals were complaining about this at the time. But everybody's, oh, no, it's good. And you'll be thankful one day when there's a huge terror attack and all the military weaponry is dispersed to all of these locations through the Department of Homeland Security. They'll have, you know, storehouses and everybody will be able to defend themselves and every community will be safe from the evils of Al-Qaeda. But when you've got all these toys and the entire, I mean, we outspend the world 40-1 on any nation for military spending. Right. What do you do with all that? You give it to people. And what it doesn't stay in warehouses. It doesn't sit around moldering somewhere and, you know, get brought out for a parade every once in a while. They've got to use it. And the only people that are going to use it are those Americans. Because that's,
absolutely,
you know, that's what police do. They police Americans. They don't police, yeah, this isn't, you know, yeah, Baghdad. You know, we aren't in the outer tribal region of Afghanistan somewhere. So that's
We're
the
not?
Problem.
Oh.
And this is, you okay. know, this is, well, look, if you look at Ferguson, Ferguson is a town of 21,000 people total. And on top of that, they hadn't had any violent crime or any murders in almost a decade until this black boy. And that's why they got so mad, because they killed a black kid, you know, that was giving up or whatever. And that's why they got so mad. It isn't that they had been suffering, you know, 50 murders a day, and this was the final straw type thing. It's like this was the first one. This was a big shocker, because this is a no-crime community to begin with. And then you turn around and see the pouring out of this, like, it looked like an invasion force,
yep,
coming to town with, I mean, they had everything from the Bearcats to the tear gas parades and barrages. And you saw that the film on anywhere you turned on. It was insane. And that's what we're seeing. This is, if it could happen there in itty bitty 21,000, I mean, wait till they unleash it in the middle of LA or something during a riot.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, you thought
absolutely.
Rodney King
absolutely.
Used to look bad. Wait until the entire militarized police force of America shows up. It's going to be a disaster.
Well, this is a disaster right now, because I can't play any of my clips. Can't play any of my early clips. But we have...
Well, you know, kind of like those police force, when they showed up on camera and they turned all the cameras down and threw all their equipment in the street. Yeah, it's kind of like that, Mike.
Yep.
You don't want to play those clips.
Well, I am I'm trying to... They have so many different... I'm getting a lot of garbage on the screen here, so I don't know what to... matter of fact, according to you, according to what I have for you, is that you're on hold. So, hey, as long as I can speak to you, Alan, a lot of clips here. So what we're doing is I'm trying to load in my next guest. And so just hold on, guest. As soon as I can get you loaded up there, I will bring you on. And it's there you are. Okay, now I'm getting a lot of advertisement here, so I don't know what it is. And who's our next guest? Who's up online now?
Chris Haley, 70%
of Mecklenburg County. Here is Chris Haley. We were just talking about you 5 minutes ago. Chris Haley, who's the candidate for sheriff of Mecklenburg County. Tell us a little about yourself, Chris, that I know that other people don't know.
Okay, well, I have over 28 years of experience in public safety as a criminal justice practitioner and also an administrator. A former Raleigh police officer, a trooper with the North Carolina Highway Patrols, and an administrator as director of public safety training for Central Piedmont Community College, where we provide training for all police officers, firefighters, EMTs, and paramedics for the county. So that's a little bit about my professional background.
Now, the thing is, why do you want to run for sheriff of Mecklenburg County?
Well, Mike, being in the position that I was in as director, I saw the need in the community to keep the community safe. In other words, I saw what was not being done, and my whole platform is built off of that. And one is, you look at Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. It's the only key player in the county of Mecklenburg, and you know, you've got close to 1 million people here now, that is not decentralized. With the sheriff's office, everything is centralized. And so what that is causing, it causing our community not to be as safe as it could or should be, because it's taking officers anywhere from 2 to 4 hours to process someone once they are arrested. Any given night, you go down there, Mike, you would see cars lined up trying to process an arrestee. Mike, it doesn't make any sense. Decentralization of that, I'm talking about in the northern and the southern end of the county, it would be a temporary detention facility. If a person not bonded out within 4 to 6 hours, then we send a van to pick them up and take them downtown. In other words, the towns like Mint Hill, Matthews, Pineville in the northern area, Cornelius, Davison, and Huntersville, look how much, how long it would take those officers to process someone. And look how long it would take to get back into their communities if anything happened. Mike, it doesn't make any sense. That's one of my biggest complaints with the sheriff's office.
Okay, so what you're saying is that when a policeman stops somebody for something or arrests somebody, they have to take them to the sheriff's department to be processed?
That's correct. That is correct.
And that means they have to come so that means they have to come downtown to the sheriff's department in order to do that?
That is correct. I don't care where you are in the county. Now look, Mike, that 2 to 4 hours don't even take into consideration the drive time.
Right.
Just imagine if you got arrested in Davison or way down on the southern end, the drive time just to get there, now you gotta wait. You're talking 2 to 4 hours. It doesn't make sense. It's a waste of taxpayers' money and public safety issues.
Well, I guess it's because they're operating the same as they did in 1840.
Absolutely, Mike. And if I don't get in office, they're going to continue to operate in that same capacity.
Okay, but you see, one of the things that I see why they're still doing it is because that means everything goes to downtown, and any graft that can be done goes through downtown also. And I'm just saying it. It ain't you. I'm saying it. Hey, there's a reason why they're still doing this in the 21st century. And when you have how many police chiefs have we had since 1840? Three?
Maybe?
And they were practically all related till Mick Mackey was elected. Then they took that away from him. what you're saying is that we're still operating like it's the whole thing is I was explaining to one of our David Adams, who's our columnist that reports into the show, he's going to be on today. I said, hey, the sheriff in the 1840s, I mean, he was it. You know, Matt Dillon, Wyatt Earp, Bill Hickok, they ran the whole county.
Yes.
And when they were elected, the daggone governor couldn't arrest them. Nobody can arrest them unless you have a coroner. And we don't have a coroner here, do we?
No, we don't.
So that means the sheriff is the highest elected official in this county. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is correct.
And that's why Joe Arpaio, down there in Arizona, he told the governor to go to hell.
Yep.
Yeah. So people have been living in tents in the desert for the last 10 years.
Absolutely. So therefore, the sheriff has more power. I mean, the police chief can't arrest the sheriff.
Cannot.
Nobody can arrest the sheriff.
Mike, that's because the police chief is in line down at the sheriff's office trying to process him.
Yeah.
Exactly. Hey, if you arrest him, it'll take too long to process him.
So what you're telling us let me get something straight though. Yeah.
Now, I'm just saying, he's coming in, he wants to streamline things, he wants to run an efficient system, maybe even decentralize it so that it just works better, serves the community itself instead of being centralized at one location so that they can stay in community and they can process in community, save time, save effort, save taxpayers' dollars. And then I pull up his website, and he has this listed. The statement of purpose of why I'm running, number one, cooperation and collaboration. Number two, education and training. And three, prevention and rehabilitation. Okay.
That's correct.
All I see is someone trying to help people, trying to make things more efficient and better. Where are the tanks and the tear gas, man? I don't get it.
That's right. Now, where's all that excess we call SEAL Team 6 equipment located at?
Well, Well, you know, Mike, you have to look at how Mecklenburg County is operated. You know, how county legislation is when it comes to police and the sheriff here. You know, the sheriff don't answer 911 calls. You know, that's up to Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department.
That's correct.
So you don't, as the sheriff, you don't need all of that. That's why you have CMPD. But now we're here to enhance and subsidize whatever they need to make their job more effective and efficient. We need to be an advocate for them to make them better. But so you got to realize that role in order to think about the tanks and all this other stuff.
That goes to my next question. I was just looking at this this fool, Thomas Jackson, who is the police chief in Ferguson. They have just released it a couple of hours ago.
You mean Wise.
Yeah, right. Just released a couple of hours ago a surveillance tape of that young teenager, Brown, and his friend Dorian, but mostly Brown, stating that he stole something from a store the day of this shooting. So the press asked the police chief, why did you release this today? Because he released at the same time the name of the police officer.
Okay.
So they say, why did you release both of these at the same time? He says, well, because you all asked me for this. So the media, next question says, well, we didn't know any about any robbery. So why would we ask you about some surveillance tape that you suspect Mr. Brown was involved with?
Uh-huh.
And he says, well, you know, that's the end. I have to go now. So what? I mean, give me a freaking break. They now want to show you that this young man was not innocent. Therefore, he needed to get shot.
No.
Well, this is one thing I would ask you. Yes.
But what happened to America where even if you're damn dirty, guilty, gutter, mafia, drug running, horrible, guilty. What happened to America?
Now,
where you arrest that
about
person
Ted Cruz
in
like that. Let's not talk about Ted Cruz like that.
Yeah,
let's
but
talk
where,
about
when did
else.
It become? When did it become shoot first? If you have any question of guilt about you, and then we'll see later if we can, you know, figure out if the corpse is guilty. When is that?
When Ronald Reagan became president. That's when it was justified. When he authorized the police forces in this country to be militarized by giving them through grants the excess equipment that our military was not using. That's when it became authorized.
Well, then to ask Sheriff Haley here. Oops, sorry, I didn't mean to jump the gun. But anyway.
No, you're right.
I don't see anything on here about, you know, shoot them in the back, shoot them first, kill them dead, make sure they're dead, drag them through the street, and then we'll try the corpse. So under your plan, I saw a whole bunch of cooperation and education and prevention. I mean, they don't do prevention and rehabilitation anymore. So, you know, are you out of step with the gun-toting Wild West America of today?
No. First of all, I believe in the Second Amendment right. I believe you have a right to bear arms. But comes with that is training and education that will make the difference. See, that's the key. You know, you got a lot of people that have guns, but they haven't been properly trained, or nor have they been educated on what to do with that gun and how to use it. So I believe in training and education to go along with that, to go a long way. So
exactly.
Hopefully that answers your question.
Well, I want to know is what I want to know is if we have the ability to through the sheriff's department. Oh, well, let me put it this way: the sheriff's department in Ferguson. This young man Brown was shot by a policeman. Okay, Why is the sheriff's department involved?
I don't know much. I didn't know they were involved other than, you know, to help with the law and order there. But I haven't seen much of the sheriff's office.
Okay, then Jackson is the police chief. Okay, my mistake.
Yeah.
All right, so he's the police chief. Okay, so now if a shooting occurs, the sheriff's department does not get involved then, right?
Not here in Mecklenburg County, no.
Okay.
Not unless they're called to assist. They have to be called out by the police chief to assist if anything like that happens.
Okay. Why would the sheriff's department, well, just let's take, for instance, the athlete from Florida State that was killed by the policeman here in Charlotte a couple of months ago.
Uh-huh.
Well, why would the – or what example would the sheriff's department be called in on a case like that?
Here in Mecklenburg, they really wouldn't be because they just wouldn't. Because of their roles and responsibilities, they wouldn't be called in for something like that.
Okay. So realistically, here in Mecklenburg County, the police chief's job is to incarcerate?
Yes, to answer 911 calls and law and order, really, in the community when it comes to criminal activities.
But you see, a 911 call, doesn't that go to the police department? You mean it goes to the sheriff's department?
No, it does not go to the sheriff's office at all.
Okay, so then when does the sheriff's department ever get involved in any, what's the circumstance when the sheriff's department gets involved?
Well, they serve civil processing papers, sex registry.
Right.
You know, if something go bad with dealing with that, then they're going to be called out. But, of course, CMPD, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department, going to be right there to assist.
Okay, what we're saying is that the sheriff's department is not going out on 911 calls.
Absolutely.
But they have the second largest budget in the South next to Atlanta. Over $100 million, am I correct?
$118 million, I think, was proposed for this year.
Okay, so what does that $118 million take in account?
Well, you're looking at detention centers, you know, your jails, because it is the largest between D.C. and Atlanta. You're looking at court security, you know, also with the civil process. But a lot of it has to do with contracts. There's a lot of contracts that run that jail.
Mm-hmm.
So if you really look at the budget, the majority of that go towards contractors.
So you're saying, are these kind
and so forth.
Are we talking about the contractors that produced the moonshine for the jails?
Well,
not that I know this for a fact, but we're not talking about that. Then we're talking about fixing up the jails. We're talking about housing and clothing.
Right. It's just like they did in the military, where they subcontracted everything out to, you know, places like Blackwater and all that other stuff that they have. Some person to, handle the plumbing, some person to handle the food, and some person to handle this and the other, but it's all subcontracted now, which also makes more money.
Yeah,
so,
that's true.
So therefore, when you got in office, this is what I want to know.
Okay.
What is the first thing you're going to do? Because as far as I'm concerned, I can't imagine, and I don't imagine, I mean, I can't think of the last time the sheriff's department has had an audit.
Had an
audit?
How do
I know an audit?
Yes.
Yeah, but you know the reason why? It's because the prior sheriff's successor has taken over, and he trusts what the prior sheriff has done. But see, I'm part of that status quo, so before I take any keys to go to that office, there would have to be a full audit. The citizens of Mecklenburg County needs to know what has been going on for all these years. We're looking at all the way back from Pendergraft to the present.
Well, before Pendergraft.
Good morning. Warning.
I mean,
but warning.
Yeah, listen, there has been, there's only been, Prendergast was a sheriff for, what, 25 years before him. The guy was there for, what, 40 years? I mean, so, you know, we're going back over the property to the 1900s.
Yeah, but Mike, did we not go through this with Nick? When he even mentioned the word, wasn't that an instantaneous, I mean, the guy got just destroyed in the press and everywhere. They started going after him like you wouldn't believe because they did not want that audit to occur. Wasn't that
exactly
the case?
Well, that was only half the story why they didn't want it to occur. I mean, it's the other half was that it's because he was African-American. That's why they didn't want it to happen.
Well, and so that's why I was saying warning. Here we got Chris coming in, and that's the that's a dangerous precedent to set if you're going to be the first guy to actually – have accountability. That's, you know, sometimes you find bodies and money where you're not supposed to.
Well, yeah, but see, the problem here is I am sure there's plenty of deputy sheriffs who would like to get rid of this old boy network that's sitting on the top of this huge figure for years. And they never get a chance to come to the top because the old boy network, you know, no teeth and cross-eyed, are still sitting at the top.
Preach, Mike. You're preaching now.
Well,
you're absolutely right.
I'm only saying what's there. I mean,
here's a question for you, Mr. Haley. So given that everything in America profoundly changed, after 9/11 in 2001, we had the Department of Homeland Security was created, and we were talking about a minute earlier about how part of the USA Patriot Act was to militarize all the police officers and put them under the aegis of Homeland Security. Seeing as how the sheriff is over, you know, the county, they're the highest official. You handle all the incarcerations and run the facilities. The police are in the street, but you're handling all the business that they're bringing to you. And that historically, in the past, the sheriffs were also in command by the old constitutional method. They were in command of local militias. Are y'all in the new pecking order, you know, with Homeland Security and all that? Are you the kind of front line of Homeland Security? Are you the authority?
No. I mean, if you look at it, see, when the DNC came here and all of that, Chief Monroe was pretty much over all of that. The sheriff's office had no involvement, very limited, if any at all.
Oh, weird.
So
okay.
Yeah, if you really look at it, no, none at all. I mean, probably very little. So the pecking order, I would say Chief Monroe, CMPD would be the primary person when it comes to that.
So it seems like actually Homeland Security kind of restructured things around the sheriff departments, direct from them to police departments.
Well, no, that's more of your county legislators. You know, that's the way that they did things with law enforcement around here. More of that, yeah, how county legislators actually did it from the state level as well.
Okay.
So it's really no mistake or fault of the sheriff's office, it's your legislators.
Man, so much has changed in the world, I'm telling you.
Yeah, so much. But, you know, there's only two counties like this in North Carolina, and that's Mecklenburg and Gaston County. The sheriff's office actually operate in this capacity.
Oh, really?
Is that right?
Yeah. It's only two.
Huh.
And
well,
why
is
that?
Is that just a relic of the past, or is it?
Well, you know, they used to have, Gaston was just like Mecklenburg. Gaston have a county police, and then they have your city police. Well, you know, Mecklenburg used to be the same way until they combined the county and the city together to come up with CMPD, Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department. So now all your towns have their chief, so there's really no need of much function for the sheriff other than detention and the role that they're actually playing now for efficiency and effectiveness. It works.
Okay.
So it took a lot of power away from your sheriff's office.
In some ways, isn't that a good thing, though, to have distributed power instead of having just one guy that's the overlord?
Tell me about it.
Absolutely. I think the way they're operating here is very effective. I see no problem with it at all. So, yeah, it's effective.
Talking about is known as 1033. Tell me about it.
Well, you know, and I have something that I wanted to play for you. I finally got it up and running while we were all discussing this. I want you to listen. This is from the Ronan Farrow show, and it's about how we got to this point of militarization.
Talking about is known as 1033. Tell me about it. Why did this come into being? Why would a police department need grenade launchers in the first place?
Well, the program came to being informally in the early 80s during the Reagan administration when Reagan off the cuff instructed the Pentagon to start making surplus military equipment available to police departments across the country. It was formalized in the 90s with the 1033 program, which established a budget in an office called the LISO program. And so since then, what we've seen is literally millions of pieces of military equipment transferred from the Pentagon to local police departments. And I think it's important to stress, I mean, this is equipment that was designed for use on a battlefield. It was designed to kill, you know, and annihilate a foreign army. And it's being used on American streets and American neighborhoods. And, you know, there's the practical problem of, you know, is this kind of ammunition or these kinds of explosives or this kind of truck, you know, sort of appropriate. But there's also a mentality problem that, you know, when you outfit police officers in camouflage, I note that the police chief said that this is being done in blue. Well, no, it's actually being done in camouflage and sort of olive green military fatigues. And when you arm them with military gear and you give them military vehicles and weapons and train them in military tactics and then tell them they're fighting a war, whether it's a war on drugs or crime or terrorism, you know, what's the effect of a police officer who assumes the mindset of a soldier? A soldier's job is to kill a foreign enemy, to kill people and break things. A police officer's job is to keep the peace and protect our rights.
So what do you have to say about that, Chris?
Well, you know, that is true, but you got to, you know, they mentioned the early 90s, but if you look back at a lot of shootings that started taking place in our neighborhoods with criminals.
Well, it was the 80s, he actually said. It was actually the 80s under Ronald Reagan who started the whole thing.
Okay, the 80s, I'm sorry. But see, you had criminals back then that had military weapons that were being used against law enforcement, and we didn't stand a chance with regular shotguns and pistols. So we had
right.
to even the playing field. And
well,
so that's what happened.
Okay, but even the playing field, they don't have tanks yet. They don't have bazookas yet, or yes. They're not laying mines like in Iraq. And if it gets to that point, the only people we can blame is law enforcement because they're giving it to them. I mean, it's either the feds are giving it to them, CIA's giving it to them. I mean, they ain't getting this themselves. So, you know, the problem is, though, when you start here in a place like Ferguson, where you have people protesting peacefully, and then you roll into town a landmine sweeper, and guys in fatigues on top of APVs with M16s who have never been in the military before and wouldn't dare go in the military because they're punks, never been in the military, but yet you put a daggone helmet on them and give them an M16, they swear they're freaking Arnold Schwarzenegger.
That's true.
They have never had the training, and not one single member of the police force should pick up anything but his 9mm unless he's had training for it. And these people have not had training with it. They said that last night. None of them had training in tactical combat. And for these sorts of situations, because it's never happened in that town, so why do they even think about it?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't know much about that town, but Mike, there's a missing piece here that a lot of people are not discussing, and you know, did they show a picture of the guy? They didn't show a picture of him, did they, who shot the off shot?
No,
the victim.
Not yet. I haven't seen it yet. I'm watching the TV now for it. They just gave his name out.
Let me give you a characteristic of that person. They're usually much smaller in stature compared to the person that they shot. Police officers are scared. They are scared. They're scared like anybody else. Because they have that uniform on, Mike, does not make them this big, brave person, to protect and serve. They are scared just like anyone else.
Well, let me explain to you. Before you go on with that, I have to agree with you on one instance. This guy was about 6'3".
Yes.
This particular cop. Okay. Now, but here's the thing. You're absolutely right about these police always being scared, because I've spoken, as I said before, I don't know if you were on the phone then, I've spoken to at least four or five police officers, black police officers, who have served more than 20 years in New York City, in the worst elements of New York City, and around this country here, including in Charlotte Mecklenburg, in Los Angeles. Every single last one told me, every one of them, they have over 80 years experience. They have never, ever, 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 ever drawn their weapon. Never. And he said, one of them I was speaking to here in Mecklenburg County, he said he took the words right out of your mouth. He said the majority of these white police officers here are scared of any black man that's 6 foot tall or taller. And they will shoot first and ask questions later.
Well,
if you check the records, he said, if you can get the statistics, he said, you will see majority of the shootings in Mecklenburg County are by police officers 4 years or less. And they have, you can check their records, and they will have drawn their guns more than four times or five times in 4 years.
Yep.
So what does that tell you?
They are scared, Mike. That's the bottom line. They are afraid. They are intimidated because these are big guys. Now, I've been in law enforcement as a trooper, police officer. I've drawn my gun many a time. But, you know, Mike, I never got in a fight. The only reason why I drew my gun there is because there was a weapon there involved. But other than that, my whole career, I never got in a fight. I had people to resist because they didn't want to be arrested. But it's how you carry yourself. But at the same time, I could have fought every day if I wanted to.
Right. Well, that's what this one gentleman here, right here in Charlotte, Mecklenburg, told me, that he was in situations where people had knives and guns. He talked them down without drawing his weapon, because they didn't. Now, he said if they would have pulled, he would have pulled also. He said, but they had a weapon, and they never pulled.
Yeah.
So, and
true.
He knew they had a weapon. He says, but if you know, it's just like one of my favorite shows on television is Justified, and about the I don't know if you ever saw it with the U.S. Marshal. Waylon, he's like the old West. He's a U.S. Marshal and is a dead shot and a quick draw. And he's told many a guy, he says, if you even think about pulling your weapon, you're going to be dead. So the thing is that's TV. And you can't do that in real life. If someone's going to pull a weapon on you, you better be quicker than them. I mean, that's all there is to it. But you see, how many times do you run into the situation? I've spoken to 80 different policemen. I mean, about four or five different policemen. They've had over 80 years of experience in bad situations and never had to draw their weapons because they talked it down. Here, it ain't about talking down anymore. I don't know what kind of lessons they're getting in the academy about de-escalation.
It starts in the academy, because they're going to tell these rookies about how many police officers from their department was shot and killed, and then they're going to give them a description of the suspect, which usually African-American males. And,
yes.
You know, already, I am scared already because I know my chance of being killed would be by African-American male. And then when I
right.
face with this situation, you know, I'm already terrorized before anything ever happens. When I was going through, young, majority of the officers who were killed back then were black males with locks. So automatically, when I saw, when I came to encounter a black male with locks, I instantaneously took precaution.
Right.
Just because of what I was trained, the way I was taught right. in the academy. And
right.
so these guys are doing the same thing. But you're having a lot of these young, mostly white males that are very small in stature that encounter a huge African-American male. Because when you're scared, Mike, you're even bigger than you ever been before.
That's right.
You know, when I look
That's
at
right.
you, if I'm scared of you, you are huge.
That's right.
So I have panic already. And the only thing I know
yep.
to do is to grab that gun and shoot.
Yeah.
Well,
and,
then
that leads,
though, directly to the question problem I see, and I don't know if we can possibly undo the damage we've done with the militarization of our forces, but my problem is exactly what you said. When you're in a bad situation, instead of having extensive training to fall back on, to de-escalate the situation and handle it, you have at every hip and joint, you've got a gun, a taser, something to attack with. So it is natural for someone in fear and trying to control a situation to reach for the quickest way to end it. And
well,
I think that's a huge problem in America because, I went to school in the 80s, and even then, when I went to school over there, I was astounded because the police were forbidden to carry weapons. They all walked around, and at best, you would see one every once in a while with a bobby stick, but a nightstick.
Yeah.
That was it, a baton on the hip, and they used it for protection. If they needed to, you know, subdue somebody or defend themselves if they were being attacked. But that was it. And I think that we've kind of gone beyond where we have weapons at the ready all the time. And so naturally, you know, disasters occur where you shoot first instead of policing first. And
hold that thought, Thomas. We have somebody else join us right now. Who's this? On the line.
This is Robert Dawkins.
Robert Dawkins? Speaking about
yes,
having
you,
a stick, how about, speaking about having a stick, Robert Dawkins has a big stick. And he walks around with it for Democracy North Carolina, trying to de-escalate and get people involved. Robert, have you been listening to some of this conversation?
I have. I've been listening to it for the past 3-4 minutes, and you know, most of it I totally agree with. The thing that I would say is, you know, ever since I've been watching MSNBC for the past 4 nights, you know, I've heard of people talking about the militarization aspect of the police department, but you know, this goes way deeper than that. I mean, you can have a RAP4, or you can have an M60, or you can have a side stick and a pistol. If you do not view black life or people of color life of being of much, I can kill you just as quick with my sidearm as I can with the militarization. And I don't appreciate the militarization, but the problem goes way deeper than, you know, the MSNBC and the normal conversation about what the police officers are walking around with. You know, back in the 60s, you know, it's a culture. It's a culture that we've got to change. People spend a lot of time talking about community policing, and I think that is a start. But until an officer sees the person walking in the middle of the street or Jonathan Farrell that just had an accident and was looking for help as a person and not somebody to fear, that's the issue that we've got to really direct our time and effort on.
Well, now, Robin, I understand for that, and I want all you to chime in on this. I'm going to give you a couple instances. In July, a California highway patrolman beat a woman who was walking along the freeway. The woman said, Marilyn Pinnock, he said he grabbed me, threw me down, and he started beating me. I felt like he was trying to kill me. I said, now, this incident occurred on the highway, and the police said, well, she was an endanger to traffic and an endanger to herself. So that means I have to grab her and beat her because she's an endanger to herself? I mean,
not even just in danger to herself. And that happened here in Charlotte, if you remember also, that the police stopped and picked up a woman that was not in total control of all of her mental faculties, and they put her in the back of the police car, and they sat there while she beat her head against the window until she killed herself. But the last brother that was on the phone that was talking from someone being trained from a police perspective is the person that really hit it on the nail, the fact that how police officers feel when they roll up on a scene and there's an African-American, especially an African-American of size, but I'm 5'7", and when I was younger, the police used to pull me over. But just rolling up on the scene.
Well, that's because you had them eyes. That's because you had the eyes. You were a danger.
But still,
look in your eyes and see you.
rolling up on a black person, and what the brother on the phone was saying a minute ago, what flashes through their mind and the immediate reaction they have seeing a black person. You know, from Michael looking at, what was it a couple years ago, the Wall Street movement, you know, there was never a case that it resulted in somebody being killed, and that was mostly white people protesting.
Yeah, what do I?
And
oh,
that never happened. If you look at just different situations over the time, the police response when it's not a person of color versus when it is a person of color, how quickly it escalates.
Well, let me give
another
example.
It can turn deadly.
Now, let me get another. On July 17th, the policeman using an illegal chokehold killed Eric Gardner. Now, of course, this man was a big man, 350 pounds. But then you could also
go.
The
brother on the phone had something to say on that too.
I just want to read you a couple of things here. Then last week in Ohio, John Crawford was in Walmart and picked up a BB gun that he was going to buy, and someone called the police. They came in and shot him in Walmart.
Yeah, but if you're living in some cities out in the Southwest, they walk into the Walmart with an AR-15 around there.
That's right. Absolutely
correct. It's fine.
That's right. And then last week, a mentally challenged young man was shot in the back because he did not act according to the police request. So, you know, it's gone beyond that. It's gone beyond excuses now. There is no excuse for this. I was speaking to Erin Dale Bird the other day, and she told me about, there's a website called the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement, and it talks about the Operation Ghetto Storm 2012 annual report on extrajudicial killing of black people, and it talks about over 313 killings since 2012. So this is just genocide. That's what it is. It's just genocide, and it's done. And now they're trying. They will always have an excuse. They want to make the excuse now with this young man, Mr. Brown, that, well, you know, he might have been wanted in a robbery. And they just interviewed the police chief, and the police chief says, well, you know, we can't identify him as the person in the store, but But that has nothing to do with the shooting. Well, if that had nothing to do with the shooting, the newspaper said, the newspaper media said to him, why did you bring it up? He said, because you asked for everything in the case. They said, but we didn't even know about this. So how could you, why would you bring it up if we didn't? Because they want to divert. Chris?
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Chris?
You know, yeah, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, you have to look at these officers now. These officers are no different than you are, Mike, and your other guests. All the difference is they gave them just a little bit more training. But they are still scared, just like we are scared, and we react according to our environment in which we grew up. You know, Mike, I grew up running, fighting, and jumping and running. And so, you know, stuff like that wouldn't excite me as much as someone who's never been tackled before.
Hey, yeah, so I didn't grow up doing that.
Huh?
I didn't grow up doing that. I didn't grow up doing that.
But see, Mike, you are more prone if you're an officer to shoot somebody if they intimidated you.
Well, yeah,
so
but listen.
The same thing for these officers. These officers are scared. It's the bottom line. Everybody
yeah, but
should be
women?
A police officer.
But they're beat. Yes, you're right. And they're beating women. Are they afraid of women? This chip officer who beat this woman had only been on a job 1.5 years. You know where he was before that? He was training dogs.
But Mike, you
because
know what? He'll,
they
beat, his
think
guy, he'll beat his girlfriend and he'll beat his wife the same way.
Yeah, absolutely
and
correct.
Officers do that too. So if
absolutely
you do the water like that, he used to beat no women.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely
no
right.
Difference.
That's right. Robert,
you
had something to say? Robert, you had something to say?
You know, again, everything that y'all saying I agree with. But I also do want to, Mike, say that, you know, we need to look at, you know, a term you mentioned, Aaron Bird. Aaron Bird taught me a long time ago a term called intersectionality. And this is a bigger issue. It's an issue that affects not only us as African Americans. And if we want to fix the problem, we need to fix it holistically. This problem affects blacks, it affects Latinos, it affects people of non-Christian faith. You know, in Alamance County, we're having to fight right now because, you know, we got the federal courts trying to look into the fact that the Alamance County Sheriff told all of his deputies, go out today and do traffic stops, and I want you to stop anyone that looks to be Latino because I want to try my best to deport them. It's a issue of culture, and I think what Chris was talking about earlier of fear, and if you're not what I normally expect to see in my surroundings, then I'm going to question you, and if I have to, I'm going to beat you. And, you know, I want people to see that it's a bigger issue. I think that blacks are most proportionally affected by it, but I do think that it also affects Latinos, Muslims, now the LGBT community, anybody that a police officer hasn't had cultural training and they run into them, there's the chance that it will get out of hand because they just don't know how to deal with people that aren't the normal white Anglo-Saxon Protestant.
Okay, well, and I agree with you, and I want to give you some statistics here. Ferguson, Missouri. We're going to take Ferguson because that's in our eye right now. Population of 21,203. That's the last census in 2010. Okay? 21,000. 8,192 households, 5,500 families residing in that city. Okay? There are 20.3% white, 67.4% black. The police force, 53 white officers, 3 black officers. Traffic stops in Ferguson, 13% white, 86% black. Okay? On the city council, 16% black. The police department, 6% black. The school board, 0% black. Now, tell me, Robert, what is the problem with what I just said? There is a major problem here. What's the problem?
There's a major problem on two fronts. One is a major problem that the African-American community is the majority, but they're not voting. And the people that are city council's going to listen to, you want to know why you got the response that you got in Ferguson? It was because after the night of looting, then they got calls from the people that are voters, probably the white resident, saying we are scared. And that's the response that you get. Scared. Now, to also counter that, though, Mike, it does not always mean just because you've got a proportionate or leaning black city council and mayor that this still doesn't happen. I mean, we can count off all of the cities that's got black mayors proportionately stronger than normal black city councils, a black city, a black police chief, and black people still get killed. So that's one thing to be considered, but it's not the end-all to be-all until we get people to see people of color being that they need to be trained not to fear and get the force. I mean, you know, use force against.
Absolutely correct. Chris, what do you say about that?
Well,
agree. What do you think about
it? I agree. It's the people that you are choosing as your police officers is the bottom line. And another sad thing is, you know, those black folks don't get out to vote. They won't come out to vote. That's a problem, too. I mean, for that to happen, and if they are, they're not supporting their own. Not saying that their own is the best candidate. I believe the best candidate should be elected. But I agree with him.
Thomas?
No, I'm absolutely 100% in agreement. I think that we have profound cultural problems in this country. One thing to note, he said earlier about all those marginalized groups, the marginalized are the ones that are also demonized. You know, we've got these, you know, foreigners invading our border, you know, this type of demonization that occurs all the time with the black male is the drug addled gang member that's going to come and rape my wife. And, you know, it's all BS, but it's the demonization of people allows you then to, same way within war, you can persecute, kill, push aside or do whatever you want to them because they aren't human, they're subhuman. So we need a cultural shift to begin with. But the key to everything, I think, and this is, you know, me coming from my educator background, and it's one of the things that I loved about having this
from Mississippi,
sheriff candidate
your educated background from Mississippi, yes, go ahead.
Well, that's why I fled to America, Mike. But my education is that is the key. Education.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons I was so excited, and that's one of the reasons I read off of his page when he said, why I'm running for sheriff and what I'm going to do. He mentioned right there, you know, top priorities, education, you know, training, things like this can prevent all of these tragedies. They can end all of the abuses that we see. You know, people, like you said, it eliminates fear when you don't think that the other is different or scary or whatever. You know, just because someone wears a headscarf doesn't make them a terrorist. You know, just because someone has black skin doesn't make them a gang member that's going to kill you. So it's ridiculous. But it's very easily fixed, but we've got to be serious about it, and we've got to fix it, not, you know, talk about it, but actually do it. And that's why I think we need strong candidates like this gentleman for sheriff, because he knows that the key is education and training.
And Thomas, let me take up for you for a minute with Michael. Michael always, since he's a northerner, thinks anything southern is woo.
Now, wait a minute.
I will tell you, though, Mike, there's plenty of northerners that can't get into Ole Miss. We got good colleges, good education, good research base down here in the South, including Mississippi. Some of my smartest
people they didn't
have down in
money. Meridian. That's because they have enough money to pay the registrar. That's all it is.
All right.
Yeah, well, the thing, hey, money works all the time. Please, hey, come on.
Another issue too, Matt. Mike, that's another issue that we're talking about. Do you also notice the response when it's a black kid that comes from a family that at least people in their eyes would see as not being from the project, not being poor, maybe somebody that we should go and fight for. The problem is, out of the cases that we name on and that we watch on TV, there's many more that happen to African Americans and Latinos that people just don't decide that they're going to go out there and they're going to fight for. I've been watching all of the stuff in Ferguson, but there's been another killing in Los Angeles, and I don't think that the killing in Los Angeles is getting its due because people have decided maybe this kid isn't someone worthy that we fight for, and that's wrong
yes.
too.
That's correct.
Yeah,
that's absolutely
that
correct.
Is true.
And I just mentioned that the killing of the mentally challenged young man in Los Angeles that was shot in the back.
Yep.
It was shot in the back.
And this doesn't.
I mean, how do we start
though we are seriously pushing, and we are right to be pushing on the racial angle, and I'm going to fight for that, it doesn't always just affect people of color. That's why we have to also really work to change this culture in the police department. You helped us, Mike, when we worked against to change the Citizens Review Board here in Charlotte. And did you see how many white people came out to complain about the police and what they had done to them?
Yeah.
It wasn't that many, was there? Well, no, there was quite a few, though, Mike, and it might
well,
not have reared itself.
Yeah.
And it might not have been the Jonathan Ferrell type incident where they killed him.
Right.
But the police having a bad day, a lot of white people in there saying, I got punched by a police officer just for him being mad at me, or my son got slammed down on the street. I know this isn't a life or death issue, but it's showing that it's a big enough issue that the police need real training. They need training on how to deal with different races and cultures. They also need training on just how to deal with if you're having a bad day and the person doesn't respond to you in the way that you want to be responded to. And
well,
that is a big problem.
Well, one of the things, but when you first started doing that, you and Matt and whatnot, it was the majority African Americans were out there. But when they saw that was shifting, when we saw it was shifting, then we started seeing the white community come out because they didn't want to seem like that they were the ones complaining. And they went through the same garbage as we did.
Yes. I don't think that it affects them at the great level that it affects people
right.
of color. But even pointing out how it affects the majority shows that people have to figure out because this is not bad mouthing police officers. I think that you know we get a bad image of us saying we're bad mouthing police officers, but they are individuals, and in their
Absolutely.
Day of life they deal with stuff that is post traumatic for them. So if you
Absolutely.
Automatically assume that an African American or a Latino is going to do you harm, and you've had to go and wrestle down and fight five of them over the past week, if you do not have training to understand that's an individual, then this kind of stuff happens. That's the main point that I'm bringing up. Now, you or I or most of the brothers on the phone can't get pulled over at a traffic stop, and when the police officer pulls us over and say, what did you stop me for? I can't believe you stopped me, and I want your badge number. We can't do that. People of the majority can, but sometimes they get smacked for doing it too.
And that's absolutely correct. Go ahead.
Mike, you know, officers have bad days. Let me give you a prime example of what I did. I mean, you know, back when I was a trooper and, you know, my wife and I probably had an argument or whatever, I took that on the job. And every woman that I stopped, if she didn't say the right thing, she automatically got a ticket. So, you know, it happens. You take what happens in your personal life to your jobs every day.
Yes, that's true. Well, listen, I don't know, because I'm not going to a job every day. My wife thinks I do that every day. Well, what's wrong with you? Who yelled at you?
Like, even though it's going to be a hard fight to fix the cultural thing, we do need to try to figure out how to do legislative fixes that, one, makes the police department ultimately accountable to the citizens and not just the internal affairs department. and we need to that is going to be huge, and we need to, since y'all were talking about the militarization, getting people back in the notion of community policing, where the police officers spend enough time in the community to where they at least even knew Michael Brown. If you're the officer for that area and that's Michael Brown walking down the street, you know that's Michael, and you know Michael's not out here doing anything wrong.
Right.
And pushing those two things, I think, are key legislatively.
It would take Robert Dawkins to move us into this next segment with his slick undercurrent notion about, and I want to talk about that, voter suppression and external threat to democracy. What is the external threat to democracy you see from Democracy North Carolina's point of view?
Well, and I was calling in today just to be Robert, but still, we could be Robert working for my job.
Oh,
but
that's right.
It's money in politics, and the money buys people to be able to get whatever that 1% of our society wants done. That's the big issue, and it's really just exacerbated itself over the past few years since, you know, Citizens United and all of that. The people that can afford to control the money control politics. Because they can spend millions of dollars on ads, they can spend many millions of dollars on lobbying, and the people don't get a fair shake in the process because it's already so stacked against them. And I'm not, this isn't from Democracy North Carolina, but I don't think they'd get mad if I said it, but let's look at Pat McCrory and him just now deciding to disclose, yes, I've had stock in Duke Energy the whole time that I've been ruling over what I'm going to decide to do with this coal ash.
You think? Well,
yeah.
Listen, I just want you to
listen
to this.
He got in trouble while he was the mayor here for still sitting in on meetings and being paid and all that kind of stuff.
That's right.
So he denied for a long time, and then he admitted that, too. So, you know.
Robert, you probably haven't heard this before, and neither have you, Chris. I just want you to listen to this short spot. Let's listen to this.
Now, many of our Christians have what I call the goo-goo syndrome. Good government. They want everybody to vote. I don't want everybody to vote. Elections are not won by a majority of people. They never have been from the beginning of our country, and they are not now. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections, quite candidly, goes up as the voting populace goes down.
What do you think of that, Mr. Dawkins?
And I want Chris and Tom and other people. I said, you said you got Tom on the phone, and he's more of an academic than I am. I'm more of a
But, just taking what the man said, what do you think of that? And I'll tell you who it is after you tell me what you think of that.
Yeah, so, I mean, and this is going back since the beginning of voting. Only people that are invested and meaning they own land, they've got money, they've got an education, are qualified enough to vote because the rest of us are too stupid to vote. And if you do go out and for some reason get all of us to register to vote, society's going to go into a hell in a handbasket because we don't know what's right for us. Totally wrong, totally ridiculous, but, you know, it's been going on since the beginning of our system, and we've got to put a stop to it as quick as we can. How do we do it? That I don't know, because when I'm in the communities every day, the people are so disillusioned. And me saying the standard answer, well, you need to vote because your people have died for it, or nothing's going to change till you vote, doesn't work. And we know that's the only thing that's going to work. And if society has all of this money, they convince you why you don't need to vote, or you need to vote for them. it's confusing. And it's depressing.
So Chris, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree with what he just stated. You know, if you really look at it, you have that right to vote, and they can come out, and the main thing is a lot of them do not know the issues. They will go vote because of name recognition, and that doesn't necessarily mean that's the best candidate for the job. So I don't know. I disagree with what he said.
Well, Thomas knows who that is. I'm going to tell you both who it is. His name is Weinrich, Charles Weinrich. He's the father of the conservative movement, and that is their motto. He says, we don't want everybody to vote because we lose when everybody votes. And he's absolutely right, because there's not many of them. So if everybody votes, they automatically lose. So the idea is like what the Koch brothers are doing, is trying to put enough smoke in your eyes and enough, excuse the expression, shit on the wall, where you don't want to vote.
Or if you do vote, or if you do vote, like with the conservatives here in North Carolina, the Voter Act, which we call the monster law, the Voter Act that they passed when they were running it through the House, it was called Restore Voter Integrity Law. So if you don't know anything about government, you say, well, heck, I want integrity. I'll vote
for that.
That's like the my favorite acronym of all, the USA Patriot Act. You know, so, you know who would vote against that? You know,
nobody.
That's right. Well, only if you're not a patriot, you would.
Yeah.
If you're not a patriot, you would.
I think you just made the list, Mike. You're on the list.
That's
now.
Right. Yeah. That's the whole key. If you're not a patriot, why would you want to vote? Why would you want to vote for this thing that says, hey, this is for patriots? So therefore, you need to...
I do see a problem on our side. I do see a problem on our side, too, though, Mike. I think sometimes we take stuff because we're so emotional, and we paint it in an image that doesn't filter down to being something that people see they need to vote for. You know, I can tell everybody all day about the monster law and give it HB 589 and all of that. What people want to hear is, that bill cuts my Medicaid. It took the money that my kids would have used to go to school and gave it to charter schools, which we see right now in North Carolina.
Right.
Most of them aren't meeting the standard. We have to come up with different messages for the different voters, all being reflected on truth, but one big message going out. You know, I've been a big, participant in Moral Mondays. But since I've been out there in the neighborhoods, in the poor neighborhoods, knocking doors, most of the people, they have never even heard of a Moral Monday. And this
That's
has
right.
been in every newspaper, on TV, on MSNBC. We've got to make our message to where everybody can understand. And the conservatives' message is always simplistic: God, country, and don't raise my taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And they can
wrap apple pie
around it. And I think all of us like apple pie, but, still, they wrap it to where it's easy to digest. And people that are affected by it, even though they're voting counter to what will help them a lot, see that as something that's important: God, country, and not raising taxes. Us progressives, we believe in God. We believe in country. We don't want to raise taxes if we don't have to, but everybody's got to pay their fair share, and we don't get a fair shake in it because people are going to come back and say, did you hear what the progressives said? They said they don't love God. How did I say I did love God? Because I want to make it fair for every religion to be around and not be preached to. How did I say I didn't love my country when, even though the conservatives might be big on saying I'm going to buy more weapons to make sure that when you're in Afghanistan or Iraq, you got more weapons, and I'm saying when the soldier gets hurt and he comes home, you've got to provide adequate care for the soldier, because I do love the country. You know, it's we've got to figure a way to get this message out to people.
Okay,
again,
but you see, the problem is, though, you can't love God if you love homosexuals. You can't.
Well,
because it says so. It says so. I don't know where exactly, but I know it says so somewhere.
I'd have to go against you, Mike. I'm on your show, but I'd have to go against you on that. And then I'd have to also counter Mike that it's up to the religions to accept how people want to live their life. But if they pay taxes to this county, if they work and their partner works, then they don't have to go to a church to get married. They can get married right here at the county, and that's my fight. I can't tell the churches what they're going to accept, but I can doggone sure say if you're a tax-paying, upstanding citizen and you want to marry somebody you love and you pay the taxes the same way that everybody else in Mecklenburg County, you should be able to get married.
Well, but see, now, where does that go? When you are here, let's say, illegally, they keep saying you don't pay taxes. Every one of them pays taxes. They pay taxes when they buy cigarettes. They pay taxes when they buy gasoline. They pay taxes when they go to a grocery store. What do they mean they don't pay taxes? I mean, this is just completely ludicrous.
Yep.
So you know, the thing is that where do we draw the line here? Do we just throw out 12 million people who are here not legally and leave their kids here? Or we throw the kids out too? What do we do?
I don't think we... I mean, Mike, if you are here and you're trying to work yourself to be a good law-abiding citizen, I don't see how you can have a Statue of Liberty that says, give me, you're tired, you're poor, you're hungry, and then turn them away. And let's not forget that through the history of time, we've always had immigrants coming in. The difference is immigrants now are of a different skin color. And I mean, I'm a big fan of The Godfather. You watched The Godfather when he came
in?
Oh,
please.
He didn't have any papers. His name became Corleone.
He didn't even have the right name.
He didn't know what else to call him. He didn't have the
right
name. But you get to get in. But now it's an issue. Again, I can see the conservatives' point, and maybe we need to do something about what's going on at the borders. But at the same time, if you are here and you're working and you're doing stuff, if it fits the conservatives' group of people, even if they're color, when it was Cubans who vote more conservative than anybody else, Latino, they came up with laws to make sure it was fine for them to come. But if you were Jamaican, you best not paddle your boat or your inner tube over here.
Exactly.
Don't we have the wet foot thing in Florida with the Cubans?
Yeah, that came about with Clinton. When the main swerves came in the 70s and the 80s, Clinton wasn't in. I'm just pointing out they came up with ways to let people that will vote their way in.
Absolutely.
And people traveling the same path. You might have been on the inner tube from Cuba or the inner tube from Jamaica. The inner tube from Cuba got treated a heck of a lot different than the inner tube from Jamaica.
Well, that's,
right.
and also the Haitians.
Yep.
Were treated horrible. So, you know, as they said, I don't want everybody to vote. I just want all people to vote.
Exactly.
So that's the whole situation. Now, tell us something, Robert, about Democracy North Carolina, and how they are attacking the problem that we have in this state.
So, I mean, and, you know, thanks again. I'm not trying to dominate the conversation, but I do thank you again for mentioning that. And, you know, Democracy North Carolina, we've been working for over 20 years here in the state on trying to provide good progressive research that people can use. We've tried to work to do as much community organizing in the community as we can and provide trainings for how people in communities can build power to take on issues like money and politics, and also trying to make the system of government more accessible. Have we won on everything? No, but we've won on quite a few things, whether it was early voting or Sunday voting, the pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. And we've seen over the past 2 years how the new conservatives administration has systematically wiped out
a lot of the things that we've worked on over the years, but we're going to keep fighting. But what we also understand is it's not us. Democracy North Carolina never sits here and says it's us. All of our stuff has come with working in coalition, whether it was the NAACP or the Council of Churches or the League of Women Voters. We try to provide the glue to help keep the effort going, but we never say that anything we did was totally on us.
Okay, well, see, that is a and what is the what are the programs or the process that you're trying to get across today, as of this week, this month?
Well, for one, we're seriously happy we were able to get a disclosure bill passed through the conservative-controlled administration that's now going to allow for people to see every time that people contribute large sums of money, like $5,000 to a candidate, that you can see exactly where that money comes from. That was our biggest win this General Assembly session. That we're happy of. But going into this election, we want to make sure that people know there's no photo ID requirement until 2016, so that is not an issue. We want to make sure that people do understand that since the big federal court trial in Winston-Salem did not stay the rest of the Munster Law, that the state has outlawed out-of-precinct provisional voting. So if you're voting in the wrong precinct, your vote won't count, and they won't even offer you a provisional ballot this year. That's going to be huge. You know, Michael, many times when I'm traveling around and we're putting people on vans and we're taking them to vote, the people forgot to change their voter registration, but they still live in Mecklenburg County. And they'd show up at a poll and they'd say, no, you're not registered here. I know it's an hour before the election ends. You can go ahead and cast a provisional ballot. You know, you bring the supporting stuff later, and the vote that you cast for the people that count for your area will count. Now that, you know, the conservatives have fixed it to where that isn't allowed anymore, and I'm scared that's going to cost a lot of votes. You know, we're pushing for people to get out and make sure that the shut-ins, people that maybe can't be promoted, taken to the polls, are out voting absentee. And I think you and myself, Benjamin Chavis and Aaron, are going to be talking about that tomorrow. That's huge. It's we're trying to show people that there's a lot on the line right now, and if you do not exercise the rights that you got, you're going to sit and look as they, you know, get diminished over time. And I know sometimes from talking to young black people, our messaging needs to change. You know, the older community says, Robert, go out in the community and tell the people on the door that you're not voting and people died for that right. And that's not always the message that an 18 or a 22-year-old, I'm sorry to say it, you know, it doesn't register with them. We've got to get out there and tell people what is affecting them, why they need to vote, and it can't just be couched in the same old argument.
Okay, well, tell us.
I want to stop taking up the time because you got other people
I wanted to ask you, this is very important. What do you tell an 18-year-old why he needs to vote or she needs to vote?
I tell an 18-year-old that he needs to vote because you can't sit back and tell me that things are going wrong and you don't vote, because then you have no excuse when it goes wrong. And if you're sitting here and you're telling me that you're 18 and it doesn't matter to you, maybe your grandmother's food stamps and your grandmother's Medicaid mess is something important to you, and I can tell you as a fact that if your grandmother made $500 a month in Medicaid in food stamps up until this last administration, it got cut to $385. Was that a reason for you to go vote? What about your grandma in her Medicaid? So your grandma right now trying to figure out how she going to pay for her food and how she going to pay for her medicine. If you care about your grandma, then maybe you should care about this. If you've got a kid already and your mother of your kid got an earned income tax credit because she was working and she's used to getting that $3,500 tax credit, that you were able to be off the hook and you didn't go to jail that month for non-payment of child support, think how many months you're going to go to jail for non-payment of child support now that $3,500 tax credit ain't there.
Ain't that the truth? Chris, how are you going to go tell people to get out to vote for you?
Well, Mike, you know, the biggest thing is they need to look at the issues. They need to definitely make sure that whoever's in that sheriff's office is the best representation for them. And I think that's what I bring to the table. We have never in the history of this county had an African-American sheriff. So how do you know what impact we can make in our community? You know, give us a chance. Let's see what we can do.
Well,
Mike,
the last one.
Mike, I want to add on to Chris with something Chris said real quick. Because, you know,
yes.
I'm not saying, you know, I can't talk about voting. But the question that I get when I go to, like, Center for Community Transitions and I get to other races, the sheriff race is the one that I'm able to paint my picture the most. And I use Aprio out in Arizona as the example. If you've got somebody locked up in Mecklenburg County, Wake County, any of those counties, the only person that decides how they're going to be treated is the sheriff. And
absolutely.
The General Assembly can't tell the sheriff how to run the jail. The city council can't tell them how to run the jail. Even the president can't tell a sheriff how to run the jail. And if you're not choosing a good person, then your family or you, when you pay that visit to the jail, is not going to be conducive to you improving yourself situation, if I can put it like that. I came from Spartanburg, South Carolina, and I've been, I'm not going to lie, I've been to the county in Spartanburg, and I've been to the county in Mecklenburg County. Boy, I tell you, you go to Mecklenburg County, they got big screen TVs, you get to stay outside your cell all day, you get to get three meals a day, they give you an outfit that fits you, they let you have two visits or three visits a month. If you're in Spartanburg County Jail, you get one visit a month, you don't get an outfit that feed you. You can say, hey, guard, it's 12 o'clock. Aren't we going to eat? They're going to say, no, the conservatives cut the budget, so you don't eat again until 6 o'clock. So go in your shell and shut up before I mace you. If you really want to paint people an image, you can paint it by how important the position of sheriff and how autonomous the position of sheriff is.
Well, and we never had an African-American sheriff. My daddy went to jail. My brother went to jail. I got uncles and cousins going to jail. So we want to make sure that they are treated fairly and equitable whenever they are in there. But like I mentioned, we never had an opportunity to make an impact in our community.
But wait a minute. Before you finish, Chris, we did have a daggone sheriff for about 15, 20, over 2 days, and then they were going to throw him in jail. I mean,
he couldn't make an impact, Mike.
Go ahead.
Well, that's true. But let's get one in there, Mike, that can be bonded, that can make a difference, and let's do the right thing for our people. I mean, because the majority of our people who are the high percentage who are in and out of the jails are all little black boys and girls. And I think the sheriff needs to be an advocate in the community. And you know, when the last time you see the sheriff in your community advocating for your little black boys and girls?
And, Mike, I will add now, again, Democracy North Carolina, we can't endorse. We can't tell you who to vote for. But I will tell you that if you are in Mecklenburg County, unless it's a parade or unless it's something that's well-planned in advance, you will never see the sheriff unless you're going to see his will once you go into the county. And I've gone out, you know, we've done, you know, voter forums, and the sheriff comes up, and there's two police cars in front of him and two motorcycles, and you get to see the sheriff for a few minutes. Nobody ever asked the sheriff any questions. They just clap, say, there's the sheriff, and they move on. And another thing I will mention is a bad thing in North Carolina has always been incumbency. Once you win a position and people do know your name and they don't keep you accountable and they don't know much about you, they just vote for you because you're in that position. And that's how you get people that sit in a position. I mean, there's sheriffs in South Carolina, where I'm originally from, that's been sheriff for 35 years. And nobody ever says anything. They never ask. And when a sheriff comes to a forum, usually nobody, he says, are there any questions? Nobody even understands any questions to ask the sheriff, because
yeah.
that's never been anything they've been trained for. They don't know anything about, you know, what's the priority that you're going to serve warrants in, you know, what are you going to do once people get to jail? What is the sheriff's department doing to do outreach in the community? People don't understand to ask this, and it's so easy for a sheriff. Joe Aprile's been sheriff for a million years, you know, because people never hold a sheriff accountable.
Exactly. Well, you know, I will be in our community, and you can hold me accountable. So let's give me a chance, Mike.
Hey, hey, you're all right with me. You're all right with me. I'll vote for you. I mean, Robin can't say that, but I can. so I will. But the problem is, though, we need more people to vote for you, not just me.
Absolutely.
And
absolutely. And
what the main thing that I want to get across and understand from Robert, from you, and from and Chris, when.
What about Thomas?
If Chris,
Thomas still on the phone?
Thomas is there. Oh, yeah,
count.
Thomas there.
Thomas doesn't count. He just
because he jumps in any time. He jumps in any time. What they think that I wanted to understand for both you two guys is that what – and I'll talk to you about this first, Robert. When people – what is the – when you're out there trying to talk to someone about – why they need to vote. Did they ask you and when they ask you this question, what do you say? Don't make no difference to me. I don't care. They're all the same.
I mean, yeah, that's the common answer that you're going to get every time, Mike. And the problem with it is, I know we moved to math and sciences as being something that's seriously important, but nobody teaches civics. In a city like Charlotte, people are so confused over what a county commissioner does, to a city councilman does, to the General Assembly does, that they say that because they hold the wrong people accountable. I go places and they say, I told you President Obama wasn't going to do anything. President Obama cut my money to schools. It wasn't the president. You know, that was something that came from the General Assembly. Or they call the mayor's office yelling and screaming, saying, what's this about the water bill going up or the tax reevaluation? Well, that's done by the county. So we've got a lot of work to make people, one, understand the levers of power in this state and how to hold the levers of power accountable, because they have no idea. Most people don't. And I think it's different in other states. You know, I think if you came, and we got a lot of transplants, I think if you came from, like, New York, then the mayor of New York was in charge of schools, and he was in charge of DSS, and he was in charge of all of that. But wherever you go, it's a different system. And people don't understand the system. And when they call and they try to work within the system and get no answers, or the services get cut, they view all of the players in government as being bad, and they use that as an excuse not to have to say, I need to spend more time working and investigating who I should hold accountable and how I should hold them accountable.
Well, and Chris, when they ask you that, who cares? Don't matter if you're in there or somebody else. What do you tell them?
Hey, it matters. It depends on your schools. It depends on experience. It depends on education. It depends on a lot of things. Look, Mike, we need intelligent people who are running these places. Your sheriff's office, your police department, you need people who believe in training and education that's going to do the right thing, not for any particular race, but for everyone, mm-hmm. and make sure that everyone is treated equally. And that's what I bring to the table.
Well,
years of experience, over 28 years.
I want – go ahead.
Go ahead. You go.
No, well, I just
Thomas,
want.
Hey, can you let Thomas chime in?
Thomas,
I think he's the academic here. Can you?
Well, no. He was having a couple of margaritas at the time, so you know it's.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. You've got a perfect example. He stated earlier to put two pieces together. You got one guy who makes people sit in tents in the middle of the desert, and you got, you know, not to diminish that, but you got, you know, big screen TVs and three square meals over here in Mecklenburg County. So who you put in office directly affects the way you're treated. You know, we wouldn't have these problems if we didn't have incompetent leadership. So we know that that's the truth. What we've got to counter is this, and I think it's intentional, but the vast amount of apathy we have in our system and disillusionment we have in our system, where people have simply given up and they literally think that their vote doesn't count because they've been told over and over and over that it doesn't count. And we've got to counter that, because that's why, I mean, I see people all the time. I talk to them, and a lot of the young people on that, they live, nothing's ever going to change. Nothing ever got better. Nothing, it doesn't matter. Corporations run everything. Your vote doesn't count. So I never vote. I don't even register. And that is a horrific statement, but it's also proof positive that, you know, 1% of the concept of how to run the government is winning. So we need to get back to people, and we need to get back to empowering people and let them know that their life is controlled by their own actions. It's not from afar. It isn't in Washington. It isn't some imaginary place way off. They control it every day. If they don't vote, they lose control. If they vote, they control. So we've got to.
You know, I can go along with that, but maybe I'm just thick. I don't understand how people who came out of the South in the 60s with fire hoses and dogs snapping at their heels and beatings and hangings and voting in tremendous amounts, then all of a sudden don't vote. You mean there was
because
a chicken in every pot?
Yeah, it might be. No, it wasn't there's a chicken in every pot, but you've got to account for a population that now the majority of the population didn't come from the 60s and the 70s, and there was not something there to polarize them. And then you've got the other people that I'll give you. My dad is an example. My dad has turned 70, and my dad is like, I don't want to watch anything else politics anymore. I got a little retirement. I'm not the happiest with it, but I've worked my whole life, and I've done all of that. These last years of my life, I'm not trying to be political or anything. I just want to live. And it's getting the senior population back in it. And also, we've got to show some more leadership. You know, At one time, I still go places and people say, Robert, you're young. I'm 45. And this is what, when I walk in the rooms, people consider young. And when I stand up and say something, at least now people will listen to me. But there's five other smart 22, 26-year-olds in the room, and nobody wants to listen to them. And they do not feel that society cares about what they say or is trying to adapt to them. And that's a major problem. And that's what the people in the 60s did. The people in the 60s made society pay attention to the youth. And now the youth make up the majority of the voting population, and they don't feel like anybody's talking to them. When I go out and I talk to people, if I mention health care, most of the youth said, Robert, I could care less about that. If all that the progressives got to talk about is health care, I want to know how I'm going to pay for my college education. I want to know when I'm going to get a job. I'm trying to get married. I'm trying to do all of this. And what I hear every day on TV does not reflect what I care about. So why would I be fired up about voting?
Well, that's one aspect of it. But to me, that's brain dead. I mean, do you believe everything you read on the Internet? Why would you believe everything you see on TV? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense. You have a core belief. You have a core belief. You should have a core belief that if this works this way, then this is a result. And if you don't do things to get a result, you will not get a result.
So they did a big study of the parents that kids were born after 1996, 98, whenever apartheid ended in South Africa. And what they found from the study was that the parents was telling the kids all this stuff about apartheid and how they should be concerned about apartheid. But it's a story that their parents tell them and in the textbook. They're not connected with the story. It doesn't mean that they don't believe that it was important, but it didn't factor in their life. And I walk around myself in my 40s and some of our other people that work throughout organizing in their 40s, 50s, and 60s. And what the young people hear is us preaching to them, and what we're telling them is not their life. You know, we're telling them about people having to march down the street for the right to walk in the front door. They don't understand that. They've never been experienced to it. We, at the same time, don't get waken up to their reality until somebody gets killed in the street because, you know, we're not the ones now at 45 and 55 and 65 that get shot for walking in the street. And the young people want to explain that to us and say, you've got to listen to us if you want us to be involved in the system.
Well, I can understand that, Robert. That's true. But the problem is, if they're getting shot in the street every day, what they're doing don't work.
Mike, this is something else I can say. I'm going to always be in the 40-year-old category. I still believe in the mass demonstrations and this, that, the other. If the young people don't see that as being the way to get it done, maybe we need to listen to them and say, how do you want to affect change?
Well,
not just
that's
telling
just what
them,
I just said.
I need you to go out and do this. I want you to go and
write a letter. No, you're right.
I'm going to tell you, organizing now is still write a letter to the editor. I go and I tell young people, you write a letter to the editor. They say, Robert, I use charlotte.com. If I want to post a comment, I post it. Why would I spend the time to do a letter to the editor? Nobody reads it. And then I got to sit here and I got to say, wow, I've been trained to tell people to write a letter to the editor, but the young community could care less about a letter to the editor. I could go and send a tweet that'll go to 50,000 people in 10 minutes. Why would I write a letter to the editor that hopefully the editorial board will print? I'm going to go and get on a van, and I'm going to go and I'm going to march up and down the street in Raleigh. And the young people ask me, well, didn't the Republicans vote against it? Yeah. So all of the people you're taking down, aren't pretty much all of them progressives? Yeah. So what is you going down there and marching going to do? You think they're going to look out the window and say, oh, my God, since we got all these people marching, I'm going to change my mind? That's a young person's concept.
Yes, but the problem is, what are they doing?
You have to ask them what they're doing.
Well,
this is the problem that I have.
Yeah, but see, here's the problem I have. They don't want to do nothing.
That's not
but complain.
True, Mike. We're not
listen,
asking
listen.
Them.
listen, hold.
Now,
Robert,
here,
I have to
really,
disagree.
This is a
Robert,
fascinating
Robert,
generational conversation.
I have to look. I have to say, look, 90% of every single young person I've run into, they don't want to do a damn thing. They want to be president. They come out of high college, I want to be president. No, you need to do this before you do. No, I want to be president, or I'm doing, not doing nothing.
I'm going to point out another generational issue to you, Mike.
Right.
That's still an issue from another generation. Nobody in their 20s says they want to be president. My dad
no,
was so
vice
proud
president.
The first black president. No, they don't even want to be. Why would
no,
you want to
I'm
be
not,
something that no,
no
matter
I'm not
why?
President.
Only,
I'm
no,
not
no,
saying
listen,
president
saying.
Of the United States. I'm not saying president of the United States. When I say president, I mean the head of the company they're working for. the head.
That's
they
the
don't
thing.
Want to work.
Young people don't want to be a head of a company. They want to start their own thing. I can make $1 million making one rap record. Why would I go and spend all of my time being a CEO, and in 15 years I'm never going to be CEO because Bank of America is going to lay me off 15 times?
No, you're correct. You're correct.
Concept.
Yeah, but you're correct. But in order to make that rap record, you need a studio, you need lyrics, you need everything else that goes along with it. You can't do it by yourself.
No, you
it can't.
But at the same time, I can show you, you know, everybody's down on hip-hop. I can show you a lot of millionaires that's been made at hip-hop.
No, that's absolutely true. I'm not talking about
turn
that.
Around and then people are going to turn around and say, well, but they don't keep their wealth. I can look at pretty much every black tent that you got, and whether you were CEO or president, you didn't keep your wealth either. But at the same time, the ideas that they have that they want to work, people turn around and beat them up and say, oh, because it's not what they believe in. You know, I watched something last night, and it was talking about something I had never heard of before, beatniks, and how beatniks became hippies, and the hippies didn't like the beatniks, and the beatniks didn't like the hippies. That's the same thing we got going on in the black culture now. I got parents telling me that they don't want their kids involved in hip-hop, and their kids don't care. And in the 60s, their parents said the same thing, because nobody wanted, their parents didn't want to listen to Marvin Gaye sing anything about no sexual healing. And now they're singing about whatever. And it's the same thing. The people that were progressives in the 60s now are so conservative to the young people that the young people don't feel that they want to work with them. And we're going to come up with their own way. And the problem about us in the 40s, we're stuck in the middle. The 60-year-olds and the 70-year-olds don't want us to serve in the General Assembly, don't want us to run for office. We haven't paid enough dues. So we're mad at them. Then we turn around at our kids and we tell our kids, well, you don't know nothing because you're not 20. The only way we're going to fix things is to get 20s, 40s, 60s, even the 80s, and get them together and see what we can work on. And I do not think that the older generation, they got a new term now called ageism, is letting the young generation lead. They're saying, you're not doing it the way that we want it done, so we're not going to let you lead because your pants are hanging down. Well, when I was a kid, Prince used to wear his pants tight and had a circle on both with his butt hanging out. My parents didn't like that. But at the same time, now I'm going to be a parent and tell my kid I'm mad that their pants are hanging down. I'm going to tell my kids that I'm mad about the music they're listening to. I'm in my 40s. When I was a kid, Luke Skywalker went to the Supreme Court and sued them so he could sing records saying pop that. Eazy-E walked around the stage and said shoot police. But now that we're older, we look at the younger generation and say, oh my God, they're out of control. We were out of control, but we still made some change.
Well,
you're
absolutely correct, Chris. What do you think? Chris?
Yeah, I agree. I have a 25 and a 22-year-old, and they say they're tired of politics. They're tired of all the bickering. The only thing they want to do is go out and make their own money, and they feel like the older generation just cannot relate to them. And we will not give them a chance to lead.
Yep.
It's a situation, you know, and I say it on my show all the time. From the moment you're born to the moment you die, politics controls your life. No matter what anybody else says, no matter what was said here, it's politics when you're born. If you don't have the right insurance that you can get inside a hospital and you're not in a room with 50 other people having babies, it's politics if you're
not
buried in a brown paper box.
We're not saying that politics isn't important. We need to figure a way to encourage young people to be in part of the system the way that they want to be part of the system. And I feel sometimes when I'm out there, I say, here's your list of options. Who's going to go protest? And you're like, I don't want to protest. Who's going to write a letter to the editor? I don't feel like writing a letter to the editor. And I say, well, Barbara, what do you want to do? Well, why don't we get this rap group to come out? We're going to get 50 people in the park, and we're going to ask the rapper when he come out that day that everything that he rap about be about voting. And to make it just a little bit more interesting, don't write it. Walk in and come off the dome with it. Wow, that's an idea, but it doesn't fit in with my generation because we don't understand that. But if
Well, that's
that
good.
Worked.
But that's absolutely worked. That worked.
And all of a sudden, if 500 people at the show registered to vote and said from listening to what that guy said or that woman said when they rap, now I'm going to vote, didn't I get where I needed to be even though I might not have liked listening to the music?
Well, you see, it's one thing, and you're absolutely correct. That's a great way to get people to come out to register to vote. The problem is getting them to vote.
And, Mike, I can show you that, too, Mike. I still don't want to be holding up the conversation. But
oh, Jay, talk it up.
Even the older generation, they all ran out and voted in 2008, and then they didn't go vote in 2010, and that's statistically proven. So they might know the system, but they only vote in presidential elections. So then go and explain that to young people. You go tell me to go vote. But Dad, the only time you go vote's for president. I just see
that's
you
right.
go vote for city council or sheriff.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. And that's because that when Barack Obama ran in 2008, there was going to be a chicken in every pot. And, you know, most people didn't have pots. So forget the chicken. But you're absolutely correct.
That's all that I'm saying, Mike. And still, like I said, I'm not trying to – but people have got to realize that. And I think from listening to my dad enough, I'm a big fan of my dad. You know, he did the 3 tours in Vietnam, made it to Master Sergeant, used to wear the fro when he got out of the Army, you know, all of that. I'm a big fan of his. But I also remember my dad saying, this rap music ain't going to work. I don't like your clothes. You ain't never going to be about nothing unless you do stuff this way. And now that I have the conversations with my dad, he said, you know, you did make it, and you didn't make it in the way that I thought you were going to make it. That's what the young people want to hear. And then they'll be more apt to work with you.
And he also said, after he said all that, but you'll never be smart as I am. So, you know, that's the game.
But you do see what I'm saying, though,
yes,
right?
Absolutely, you do see
what I'm saying. You know, when I told my dad I was going to major in political science, he thought it was the stupidest thing in the world. You had to get a business degree, and you're not. What are you going to do with that major? And you're not going to be able to work in it. And stop playing that LL Cool J and Run DMC. And why are you wearing your pants like that? And it took years before my dad finally came back and admitted, you know, you really have done some stuff with your life, and I didn't like that Run DMC and Dr. Dre and LL Cool J and Will Smith, but they're billionaires now. You know, young people want to run David Banner, since we got somebody on the phone from Mississippi. Mississippi has David Banner, one of the smartest rappers you're ever going to meet. The young people would like to see David Banner elected to Congress from Mississippi, and the thing that's holding him back is the older generation says that they can't see voting for anybody that was a rapper, but he's seriously smart.
Yeah.
Well, he's smart enough to make $1 million.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but see,
I don't know if Tom's even heard of David Banner. You heard about David Banner down there, Tom?
Yes. I still try to keep up with the old country, but I don't go back home much.
Yeah.
The
but
old
that's,
country.
That's
what it is.
That's the point. Chris brought it up, too. There's plenty of people that will sit here and say, we've never had a black sheriff. I don't even know if I'd vote for a black guy sheriff. You know, you remember, what was the guy that ran a few years ago? And I don't know if people supported him or not. Nick Mackey. When he ran for sheriff, they put ads in the paper. They put, you know, the editorials in the paper saying, you elect a black man to be sheriff, and he's going to let all the black people out of jail.
Yeah.
He wouldn't have done that. He wouldn't have done that. But it was easy to say.
Yeah, that's true.
No, it's just the usual. Same old, same old.
Yeah, I was just listening to someone just text me. But you're absolutely correct. The thing that we have, and I have to say that, Robert, see, I'm probably older than all the rest of you on the phone. The thing is, you need to come to the table if you're young with the idea, because most of the older generation, they want to see things in writing. They don't want to hear no half-seen idea.
Let me give you
Go ahead.
Let me give you one example. Most of my interns, yesterday I was not feeling good, but I have two NAACP-appointed interns. I've got a young lady from Equality, North Carolina. I got four other organizers that are in their 20s. I didn't feel good yesterday. I didn't show up for the rally downtown. They turned out 500 people. And from watching it online, they handled it great. They didn't handle it the way that Robert might have handled it. But they handled it where when I looked back, I had to say that this group of three 19-year-olds and two 24-year-olds supervising them did it not only as good as probably what I could have done, they did it differently than what I probably would have done, and it was still great. And there are plenty of especially African-American kids. Everybody wants to, one, say that nobody's doing something when that's the minority. Most of our kids are involved and are doing stuff, and people just want to look at the ones that don't. And then people also want to judge the ones that's doing stuff. Just because you've got your pants hanging down and your hair braided doesn't mean that you're not smart, you don't have ideas, and you're not a leader. It's our prejudice that stands in the way.
Yeah, well, what do you tell these old geezers that say, well, you look at young people don't do jack. He said, you look at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, right over there, and they got 5,000 registered voters there, and less than 500 turned out to vote.
I can tell them, I can show you a time, as long as I've been living in Charlotte since 1996, there's been way more registered progressives than conservatives, and they still let the General Assembly fall into the wrong hands.
Absolutely.
They still let people get elected. So the people that are preaching sometimes need to take a step back. You know, I was watching another friend of mine that's a leader like you, Mike, and he was just telling me all this stuff about you know, what's going on with, you know, out in Ferguson and how he wouldn't stand for it. And because I was sitting there having a beer, his boss called, and he jumped to the phone. It was yes, sir, no, sir, quicker than any 22-year-old. Why? Because he got more to lose. And he still didn't get
That's
it.
That's right.
Because I'm looking at
That's
him
right.
funny. As soon as he hung the phone up, he went back to being Stokely Carmichael. But, you know, when he was on the phone, he was Mr. Drummond from Different Strokes.
He was Roger Rabbit when he was on the phone. Huh?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. I'll have that report to you by 5.
Matter of fact, I'll have it at 4:15. And the thing is, the thing is that we're in a situation today, which I am, partisan as I am, and when I'm on my radio show, and nonpartisan when I'm the capacity of the president of the North Carolina Charlotte Mecklenburg chapter of North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus, trying to mesh the two together, so people understand that it doesn't matter. I say on my show sometime, just because you voted Democrat or Republican your whole life, maybe you were wrong, because both sides have neglected their constituents. Both sides.
And you're going to hear that tomorrow. I'm going to tell you, tomorrow when you have Ben Chavis there, this is a person that I listen to, and I've adopted a lot of the stuff from it. Ben Chavis, 65 years old, but he helped start the Hip Hop Caucus. He's traveled the country to do stuff. Ben Chavis can tell you everything that's going on from the rap movement to what went on in 1948. He laid it down, went to jail for Wilmington 10. He's been president of the NAACP. He helped work with rap groups. He is what we're saying when you get older, if you're looking for a way to form coalitions about change, this is a person that if you hear tomorrow, I think you'll walk away with something. Now, does that make everybody like him? No. But he is somebody from the older generation that sees bringing in young people, understands working in coalition, and even understands to a point compromise, even though if the compromise isn't worth it, he'll still lock himself up, go to jail.
Yeah, absolutely right. Well, I've already gotten our pastor Father Carl at Lady Constellation has already received an ugly phone call about him coming there. And Father Carl, who is very straightforward, said, gentlemen, are you a member of this congregation? He says, no, and I never will be. He says, well, in that case, you can go to hell. And hung up.
Yeah. And I'm not saying that you personally have to like the guy. But what I am saying, when we're talking about this, about youth, middle age, seniors, he's always come up with a plan. When I go to a meeting and it's a Ben Chavis meeting, and, you know, I've been to Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson meetings and whatever, he makes sure that there's somebody from every age group, and he opens up dialogue to say, how can we all do whatever we can do to contribute to the movement? That part from him I respect.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And as long as we can get just people to understand that they have to contribute. You know, it's the passion of the Bible. It says where Christ said, render unto Caesar that is Caesar's, render unto God that is God's. And my twist on that is, if you don't render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, then you get the Caesar you deserve. And that's it. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, hey, if you're not going to participate, hey, you are the problem.
And Mike, I'm
you
sorry
are the
I'm
problem.
Jumping off to go to my next meeting.
That's all right.
I learned a lot from Tom today. I learned a lot from Chris. Can't endorse you, Chris. Wish you the best of luck. And we will see you tomorrow.
He can't endorse you, but he can vote for you. So that's a different story.
Well, anyway. We need to vote. Thank you.
Talk to y'all guys.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
And Chris, I thank you for being a part of this conversation, and hope all the best. And I will vote for you.
Well, thank you.
How about that?
Now, I don't know if you told Tom, but, you know, I'm a registered Republican, but I'm a Colin Powell Republican.
It don't matter, Colin Powell Republican, as long as you're not a Ted Cruz Republican. You know, give me a break. All right. So, all right, Chris. I don't know if you're going to get a chance to come tomorrow. I hope to see you there.
What time? I'm hoping to be
o'clock.
There. I got a lot going on. 10 o'clock?
10 o'clock. 10 o'clock.
And
where at? 10 o'clock. It's at Our Lady of Consolation Catholic Church, 2301
okay.
Statesville Avenue in Charlotte.
Okay. Well, I'm going to do my best to be there, but I know
okay.
I have two other events, and I would love to be there.
Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Okay, bye-bye.
Let's see. Robert, you're still here? I got someone on the phone right now. Let's see who this is. Let's see. Who is this here? Hello,
hey,
who's calling? Yes.
Michael, Randy, how are you doing?
Fine. I'm doing fine. And let's see. We got somebody else on the other phone here. Hello, who's this?
Hi, this is Rick Pratt from Blue Magic.
Oh, Richard Pratt, how are you? Okay, you hold on just a minute, Richard.
Yes,
Michael. So Randy, what's the story? Where are we situated? Where are we at as far as absentee voting in this state?
Well, the Board of Elections has come out with their rules, and where we're at is that you can go online in these counties, and some of them will allow you to fill it out by email, and others you have to send the request in, but people are going to be able to request their absentee ballots, and as I said before on the show, the law allows you to request for near relatives, so if you have sons, daughters, parents, grandparents, even, you know, stepkids or step parents, you can request a ballot for them, and the ballot will come, and in fact, you can have it sent to one address and deliver the ballot to them, and they can fill it out and send it back in. It has to be witnessed by two subscribing witnesses or a notary.
So if you have a notary, you don't need two witnesses.
Correct.
Okay.
Vice versa. So having a notary in the location to notarize the ballots eliminates the need for two witnesses, and it kind of gives it the good housekeeping seal of approval in my mind.
Right, right. Well, that's what we're planning on doing we're going to announce tomorrow to have as many churches get as many notaries as possible at their. We're going to try to do it on a 2 day period, a 2 Sunday period in September, where they can all send them in all at one time. So
they can all make the request. All have it sent back church or to their address, and then when they get them, they can all come in, and you can have a democracy day.
Right. Well, they can have it sent to the church, or does it have to be sent to the house? I thought it could only be sent to the house.
No. If you read the application, you can request it and have it sent to an address. So if you're requesting for a near relative, but you have
right.
to be a near relative, so I cannot request the ballot for Michael Lawson.
Right,
because
right,
we're not
right,
near
right,
relatives.
Right.
But I can request mm-hmm. one for my wife. I can request
right,
one
okay.
for my mother, for instance. And
right,
it can be
right,
sent
right.
to my house. When the ballot comes, I would deliver it to them. Or you could have it sent theoretically to the church, and you could have a couple hundred ballots sent there, and then invite everyone in, and they vote.
Well, that works for me.
You have two subscribing witnesses, or you have a notary. That notarizes the ballot.
Okay.
And then they need to be turned into the Board of Elections.
Now, this is nothing new. This has been around since, I was looking it up. It's been around for, in Europe for years, they've been doing it.
Well, I mean, they've been doing
countries.
Absentee or mail-in ballots for decades. And in fact,
yes.
One famous election in North Carolina turned in the 1920s, a gubernatorial election, on the use of absentee ballots that came flooding in from the western part of the state. Mm-hmm. And there were accusations of voter fraud. But
of course.
It's not unusual for people to do it, but now they have better methods for tracking the ballot. So if you request a ballot, it's going to say a ballot was requested by or for Michael Lawson. So it's mm-hmm. already going to be logged in. And they will have a record of so many ballots that were requested, and then they get mailed out. Obviously, military personnel also do this. Have
right.
to request and they come in under a different category. If you ever look at the printouts of the Board of Elections, it'll say MIL, and it means military. And then
right.
you have another category of folks that have requested absentee ballots because they know they're going on vacation or they're going to be in Europe or what have you, and they have a mail to them, or they may be out of town and they can't vote in person, but
right,
they're a registered
right,
voter
right.
in Charlotte.
Well, we have on the line with us Mr. Richard Pratt, who is the lead singer for Blue Magic. Blue Magic or Richard Pratt is going to be performing here in Charlotte September the 6th. Which is going to be a part of our second initiative into absentee voting. And Richard?
Yes, I'm here, Michael. How are you?
I'm doing fine. And we are great to have you here coming to Charlotte September the 6th. You're going to be bringing in people from across, well, where are they all coming in from? Did I lose you? Hello? Yep, we lost him, Randy. I don't know what happened.
Well, Michael,
he just dropped.
All I can say is, as the chairman of the North Carolina Democratic Party, I love the name of this group, Blue Magic. Let's hope
yes.
this fall has a lot of Blue Magic.
Yeah, you think so?
How could I not like the name of that group?
Yeah, you can. I always love the name of the group. Have you gotten involved with anything that is going to, as far as the absentee voter initiative, and Richard, I'm going to hook you up in just a minute, just so you come back up. Let me put it this way. What barriers have you run into for the absentee ballot initiative?
Well, the only barriers is just explaining to people, how to do it. I mean, right now people are used to basically going into early voting or going in on election day and voting. There are a number of people that have been doing absentee ballots for years, and the Republicans have been doing it for years, specifically with people in assisted living facilities. So it's not an unusual practice. It's just something that we need to get our people used to doing, specifically because you do not need a voter ID, which aren't going to be a problem in the 2014 election, but it will be in the 2016 election, to vote with an absentee ballot. As long as you have two subscribing witnesses or a notary, you can vote the ballot, seal it up, and mail it in, or drop it off at the Board of Elections.
Well, you see, but we were just talking to Robert Dawkins about this, and he said that what will be a problem, he feels, in the 2014 election is people who go and try to vote, and it's not their precinct, and it's too late for them to go to their precinct.
Out of precinct voting?
Yeah.
And, yes, that's one of the seven elements of the House Bill 589, the horrific voting law. Yeah, the out-of-precinct voting. But the blue magic about absentee ballot program is it solves that, too. If you request a ballot, it doesn't matter. You can mail it in forever.
That's correct.
It solves all the problems.
That's right. And that's the key, which is going to be great with absentee ballot voting. It don't matter where you're at.
Right. It doesn't matter where you're at. I mean, the key to this whole thing is if you have a church and, let's just say, fine, we're pushing this for democratic purposes because we want to increase turnout. Obviously, people will split ballots and some people will vote for, all Democrats, all Republicans. And obviously, I would hope that people would vote for our folks. But I'm putting democracy here. And in a church, most of the folks are related or they have family. One member of the family could take the lead and request these ballots on behalf of their near relatives. Have them mailed to the church, and you can have a democracy day and a fish fry. Nothing that says
right.
You can't do that.
Well, what we're going to be doing is called Polls to the Souls.
Polls to the
at
Souls. I love it.
Polls to the
You're
Souls.
You're bringing
right.
democracy
and
to the people.
That's correct. So we're bringing democracy to the people, and a lot of people I spoke to were sort of leery of it because they had never been familiar with it. They'd never even talked about it. They heard the words, but that's all they heard was words. So this is something that people should try to get used to doing, and we have time now before 2016, although we'd like to change a few of the things in 2014.
I think that if because we're going to try to do this in Fayetteville and a couple other locations where I'm working with these groups of churches where you can actually communicate with a wide range of people. I think, Michael, if you can pull this group together when I come down tomorrow and we talk about it with the other folks, that it's a beta test in 2014 and we can iron out all the problems. If we could get a couple thousand people to do this and figure out what went right, what went wrong, then it can scale up in the municipal elections in 2015, in Charlotte, for instance, and be ready for 2016. So
well,
if you
that's
what
that,
enough of these churches to do it.
Well, yes,
if you have enough of these churches, the souls kind of operations, people will get used to it. The only thing they're leery of is, we're all going to be in the same room and we're voting, but so be it. I mean, I could see how it could be easily organized. Churches are great at organizing people to do these kind of things.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. And one of the reasons that I thought it was so great is to have Richard and his group Blue Magic to be a part of this second phase of our absentee voting initiative. And right now, I want to just put a little bit of something in here just to, I would like you to listen to this, Randy, just for a minute.
Mm-hmm. west of Mississippi. He's just a face painted on a smile, jumping up and down and making people happy.
So, Mr. Chairman, I mean, how is it like operating in a three-ring circus in Raleigh?
Well, you know, they always say that the Democratic Party is the big tent party. The only thing I'm trying to get rid of are all the elephants that keep coming in the tent.
And there's nobody with shovels behind them, right?
No, there aren't anyone with shovels behind them. It's difficult enough to keep our folks in the game. I'm going to say something right now that's the truth. There are a lot of old-time Republicans, many of whom I've worked with over the years, that feel like their party has abandoned them. Some of them have become unaffiliated voters, and they are essentially moving over to the party. But you know, they're trying to make the Democratic Party kind of in their image.
Right.
And you can see that with where Hillary's kind of, you know, vectoring off to the right.
Mm-hmm.
What's she trying
right,
to appeal
right.
to?
Right, of course, right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
I mean, she's not appealing to the Michael Lawson voter.
Nope. No, I don't think so.
No, she's appealing to a voter that is coming to the party. The truth is that the Republican Party has been dominated by Tea Party elements, and even longtime business Republicans are embarrassed.
Yep,
and
yep,
so when
yep,
I
yep.
say Republicans, I'm being serious about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Elephants.
Richard, how did you guys come up with that song, Three Ring Circus? Were you at a circus? Where did that come from?
Well, Bobby Eli and Vinnie Barrett are the writers of that
mm-hmm.
song. And they also wrote Sideshow, which was our biggest song.
Yes.
And, you know, trying to establish identity in the music world, you know, at that time, all the old school tenor groups, we kind of moved that way because it was, it was telling a good story with great music, you know, and up until the times, those are the things that we grew up on. So Life as a Three Ring Circus was really something that everyone really can receive because it's true. Life is a three
yes.
ring circus.
Yes,
you know,
that's
there's
true.
Ups and downs. There's things that you have to go through. I'm so happy to be on the show because this is so informative, the information that you are sharing with everybody. And it's just a good thing for me to hear because these are some things that I don't know. But I'd like to invite everybody to see Blue Magic Live Saturday, September 6th, 2014 at the Neighborhood Theater. It's 511 East 36th Street, Charlotte, North Carolina.
And Mr. Chairman, I think whenever the Democratic Party wants to have a fundraiser, I believe we could be persuaded to get Blue Magic with Richard Pratt involved with that.
We can. You know, I'm a musician, Richard, and tonight I'm a percussionist. And so
okay.
I was a four-term mayor of our town, and we started something years ago called Mayor's Jam, where I had all the musicians and artists within, you know, the Tri-County area come over. I have a stage at my house and soundboard and all that stuff, and we play. And we try to get people together that wouldn't necessarily play together ordinarily. And I found it was a good way through culture to reach people regardless of their political values using the music, using the arts.
That's always been a great comfort to people, you know, to drop the guard to so they can relax, they can hear you.
Exactly.
You know,
sometimes
we're so tense. Go ahead.
It's true. I'll tell you a funny story. There was a kind of a heavy metal guitar player. There's a local business guy that makes cabinets. And, you know, he knew a lot of minor chords, and he liked to play. We play all kinds of music, and he was very much into Sarah Palin. And if I hadn't known him through the music, I wouldn't have been able to say, why are you into Sarah Palin? I mean, you own your business. What's good for you? Turned out, he had a crush on Sarah Palin. And all the rest of us said, look, you're never going to date Sarah Palin. This isn't the basis of who you should vote for because you think you might have a chance one time to meet her and take her out. You need to know what you're standing for. And because we played music together for years, he was willing to, like, accept that. And finally, he moved on and said, you know what, you're right.
Dreamers, there's nothing wrong with dreamers.
But I could never have done that if we had just met at a bar. You probably would have punched me.
That's a good story.
I mean, music allows you to do that, right? When you play with someone long enough, you can actually have those real conversations.
Well, it just opens, it sets the mood, you know, it just sets the mood for people, you know, because people can understand, but they have to be in a relaxed mood. And sometimes things are, you know, for whatever reason, seem to be tensed, and especially knowledge is shared. Things seem to be tense because, for whatever reason, times when you have some nice music or something folks can relate to, you can be a lot more informative. Not that you've done anything different. It's just that you set your atmosphere and you set your tone.
Lost you again.
I'm with you on that, Richard.
You back? Richard, lost you.
Yeah,
I think
I
we just lost Richard
on that.
Mr. Chairman, what is the plan or strategy for tomorrow?
The plan is you've lined up an incredible assortment of people to come and talk about. You there?
Did I lose everybody? No, good luck everybody, because I still got you guys online.
Michael,
I'm still here.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
I can't
hear
any. Okay, now I hear somebody talking. Hello?
Michael.
Can't hear anybody.
I can hear you.
I can hear
Hello?
You.
Hello?
Michael, I can hear you.
Let's see if I do a reload here. Maybe that'll load you guys back up. I don't know, but let's just see here. Because everybody's still online. Hello.
Yeah.
Are you guys back?
I'm right here.
Hello. Richard?
Yes,
Randy?
I'm here.
I lost everybody. What happened here?
I'm here.
We're here.
I can see you guys are still online, so I have no idea what the story is here. What has happened? And I'm going to, let's see, Skype. It has to be Skype again. 1, 2, 3, we're online, but I can't hear anybody else. Oh, let's see here. We just lost, what do we lose? We just lost the chairman. Richard,
I'm gonna hang
if
up
you're there, that. Hang up and call me back. Oh, you're there. I hear you now. Hello? Okay, now you're going in and out.
Oh, okay, what do I need to do?
Okay, no, you're all right now. Keep talking.
Okay, what I was going to do is possibly just call you back.
No, you're fine now. I hear you fine.
Well, just want to remind your listeners again, a night featuring the legendary group Blue Magic live, Saturday, September 6, 2014. Come on out to the Neighborhood Theater and let us entertain you tonight. It's a night of entertainment, excitement, empowerment towards a great cause. Let us all join and help someone and lift someone up, and let us support the leadership caucus, yes. The Black Leadership Caucus.
And what I'd like to play is something from your past one more time, Richard.
Okay.
That's all I can do.
So when I say that with you,
I know you love me, so we can start a whole new day. I know you love me, so we can start a whole new day. I own the spark.
brings back memories.
Yes. Hey, every time I think about that, I think about red, green, and blue lights in the basement.
You're telling the age.
And what I used to do is I had to take out all the white lights and put those red, green, and blue lights in the basement before the party began.
Nothing like that, a beautiful atmosphere.
And my mother and father say, well, why is it so daggone dark in here?
Hey,
this is dark.
Young people trying to have fun, you know. It was decent in order. We didn't go with like these kids. I didn't mean to take that in conversation, but we were clean cut. You know, we were.
Well, yeah. Hey, well, listen. Well, yo, I'm from New York City. I mean, we were drinking at 18 years of age. Matter of fact, in my basement, we had a finished bar, a wet bar. So, you know, that was the only place where the white lights were. Because we had to see what we were pouring. But, you know, no, this really brings back a lot of memories. Your group, that we are going to have a fabulous time on September the 6th. And it is the second phase of our initiative on voting absentee ballots. And you guys, where are the rest of your crew coming in from?
Well, we're coming in from a different places, Long Island, New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey. But I just want to, again, shout out and just say it's a pleasure and an honor to be a part of giving a portion of the proceeds and benefits to low-wealth persons and to people of color in your community.
That's what we're trying to do.
Third chapter of the North Carolina Black Leadership Caucus, and we just take our hats off to you, and any time that we can help support you in any way, we would be honored.
Well, I really thank you. I want to thank you for giving us a shot here and making this show a super, what's it, super fragilistic, expialidocious show. So remember.
To say that because I don't know how to say that anymore. There was a time when you could just roll it off your mouth.
That's right.
We're going to have a great time, Michael. It's Blue Magic Reloaded 2014 with Richard Pratt. It's just going to be an exciting night with Ivory Bell, Don Nod Nottingham, and James Lee. We're just going to have a wonderful, wonderful time.
Well, we are, and I want to thank everybody for listening. And we're going out with, you said your song, Sideshow. Hey, everybody have a great weekend. And, hey, next week, I want to do this again, Richard.
Okay, I'll be very happy to come in, and by then we'll have some of the new songs for you. Maybe you can play one or two.
Works for me. Okay. Good night, everybody.
Thank you, Michael.
Yep.
Stand in line, get your tickets. What life has done to those like you and me. See the man with the broken heart.
by Coca-Cola, McDonald's, and Chevrolet.